Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury inviting you to come and see why J.D. Power & Associates rated Lincoln Mercury top on your list with extensive...
9743.
For the bashful and when the phones are
Busy. We have six lines and we fill them up.
Yeah, well, they're all on hold now. Can you take them off?
Yes.
Yeah, all right, good.
That
now
might
you can
help.
For the bashful...
Details.
Yeah, for the bashful and when the lines are filled, there you go. Call TalkYes at Yahoo.com. Man, I don't... Okay, I was just seeing how I sounded. Well,
Can I start by, I just want to do, I mean, it's kind of personal, but I'd like to thank the Gulan family in East China. I had a lovely holiday dinner with them, and I just wanted to thank them for their hospitality. And we had lively political conversation, and the great news is most of it was on our side.
Good. Yeah. I wasn't invited, naturally.
Right. Well, you had to work.
I did. One of the things I did last night, I can't believe this, I saw the last 10 minutes of that 1956 movie with Charlton Heston, The Ten Commandments.
Have you ever seen the whole thing?
No.
I haven't either. It's very long, isn't it?
I have no idea.
Know, our ADD prevents us from watching things.
It was so awful. It must have been made by atheists to drive people away from religion.
Okay, please explain.
Well,
why
I just saw the end. Well, here...
you mean the effects? I mean, yeah. They're a little archaic.
Heston looks like one of these typical right-winged, fanatical figures who's in touch with... I mean, I guess according to the story, he really was in touch with God. But I'm talking about... Don't get offended if you're a Christian or somebody that... Jews are into Moses, aren't they? Yeah, he was a Jew. Yeah,
right.
A lot of those guys were. Who else? There was another famous Jew.
Oh, wait. J.C.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
anyway, so he comes out. He gets the Ten Commandments. Remember that? Was it the 10,000-year-old man that said originally there was 15 commandments, but Moses dropped one of the tablets.
Yeah.
This is terrible. If this offends you, I don't care.
You're not sorry?
No, what the hell? Come on. You're not like these crazy Muslims that you do, that you make it like a cartoon of the head of the deal, and then you want to, kill people. That's you're not like that.
Okay, and I think that you should also take that, explain that. You mean the extremists.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Al Slayer, who is answering our phones at 313-298-WRIF, says it's almost 4 hours long. That movie is awesome, he says. Real classic. It's classically awful.
Al, just, give us the cliff notes.
Yeah. So at the end, I just see the end. So
he gets,
the acting is so abysmal. I mean, Charlton Heston is always, an average actor.
Well, we're not big fans of him anyway.
And who was, there was another guy who played Joshua, who was real famous in the 50s, real handsome guy, terrible actor. And so Moses comes down with the tablets, and he looks down at the Israelites, and they are partying. Let me tell you, they are partying. Yeah. I mean, wild partying.
Right
and
on.
I'm thinking, I would like to be there. So this mean old man comes down with a whole bunch of thou shalt nots.
Oh,
they're
it
having a good time.
Party.
No one's getting hurt that I could see. But they had the guy that was head of the golden calf religion. The people they want him to, go with this golden calf deal is Edward G. Robinson, which I'm just thinking, well, how miscast is this? I just can't believe it. And then the worst effects, the golden calf gets exploded and then this crater opens up and all the bad people fall into the crater. I'm going, oh, my God.
Wow.
I mean, these people are whatever. Well, happy Easter. Actually, on a very, 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 very unhappy note, the U.S. death toll in Iraq hits 4,000. 4,000th service person.
Banner Day yesterday, right?
Yeah. Has hit 4,000, as Associated Press says, a grim milestone as the war enters its sixth year. And
I think 41 died yesterday alone.
Well, it's...
that we know of.
No, not soldiers. Iraqis.
Iraqis, right.
I mean, the Iraqi people, we've suffered 4,000 in like every war like this, like the Vietnam War, is that 10, 20, 30, 40 times more of the people whose country we've invaded and occupied wind up getting what we're understandably so concerned and upset about. So 4,000, maybe 30,000 Americans wounded, 60,000 with post-traumatic stress disorder. We were last thousands of men deafened and on and on and on and on like that. And not the, they still don't have all the equipment that they would like. They still aren't getting the proper treatment that they deserve.
Absolutely. When they come back here, we've heard, you know, from returning soldiers about how they've been treated.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely horrendous.
Here's a headline from MSNBC. Iraqi extremists strike green zone. Violence kills at least 57 through Iraq. Deadliest attack strikes Mosul. And it gives this whole discussion how rockets and mortars are pounding Baghdad's U.S.-protected green zone Sunday. And it struck me here in the headline, Iraqi extremists strike green zone. Why is this extreme compared to what George W. Bush has unleashed?
Agreed.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
I mean, really, who is the extremist in terms of violence perpetrated?
And if anyone can answer that, 313-298-WRIF, please tell us.
Yeah, well, this was a few days ago. George Bush said they were talking about Afghanistan. He says, I must say, I'm a little envious. If I were slightly younger and not employed here, I think it would be a fantastic experience to be on the front lines of helping this young democracy succeed. It must be exciting for you, he told these soldiers. In some ways, romantic. In some ways, you know, confronting danger. You're really making history, and thanks. People remember that George W. Bush was able to get out of the Vietnam draft because his rich daddy skipped him over hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people to get him into the Texas Air National Guard. Then he went AWOL. He had the opportunity to take part in a romantic exercise of war, to be on the front lines, you know, as he said.
As he says he'd do today if he were younger.
Yeah.
Now, you've really got me going with that one. I missed that one this week, Peter.
He is just so reprehensible, but somehow, I don't know, he's just like this rich frat boy that never got on the clue bus.
Right.
And never understands, really. I mean, he's just, you know, a glad hander that has gotten through life because he's rich, privileged, never had to experience any negative results of all the abysmal mistakes he's made throughout his business and his political career. But the real Darth Vader, of course, is Dick Cheney. In an article by Ralph Nader called Bush Blisters the Truth on Iraq, you go to counterpunch.org, counterpunch.org, which I would recommend you doing frequently, as I do. He's talking about the war. He said, at the same time, his vice president, his prince regent, Dick Cheney, was having this exchange with ABC's Martha Raddatz. Raddatz, two-thirds of American people say it's not worth fighting, and they're looking at the value gained versus the cost in American lives, certainly, and Iraqi lives. Cheney, so?
Really?
Yeah, that's what he said. So? Raddatz, so you don't care what the American people think? No.
He's just vile. And evil.
Yeah.
And unreal.
Cheney's company, Halliburton, owned KBR, Kellogg Brown Root. And here's an article from the March 20th New York Times on GI's death prompts two inquiries of Iraq electrocutions. And I thought this was going to be about execution.
Yeah.
On January 2nd, Staff Sergeant Ryan D. Masseth, a 24-year-old Green Beret from Pennsylvania, stepped into a shower at his base on the Radwaniya Palace complex in Baghdad and was electrocuted. Now, 2 months later, his death has resulted in both a congressional investigation and a Pentagon Inspector General's inquiry into similar cases. Apparently, that this has happened 11 other times. Separately, Sergeant Mathis' family filed a lawsuit on Wednesday in a Pennsylvania state court against KBR, the defense contractor that had been in charge of inspecting the wiring at the base where the soldier died.
So they're not even taking care, not even giving them proper facilities.
Not even a shower.
There. Not even a shower, right?
Man.
It's not even safe to shower.
And then it comes back to Dick Cheney's doorstep, his company, which has made tens of billions of dollars and from which he still gets money.
A healthy pension.
Yeah. There should be still some out on the free racks. The Metro Times this week here in Detroit. I say that because I know people are listening all around the country and all around the world. You go to metrotimes.com And thank you, Kurt Guyett. Kurt Guyett, who's the news editor of the Metro Times, is just probably the one of the best writers in the country doing particularly weekly. I don't know. Well, that sounds like I'm limiting it. He's just one of the best investigative reporters, and the opinion pieces he does are amazing. So in the March 19th to the 25th, so this will be out still Monday and Tuesday, Bloodletting and Greenbacks, Calculating the Cost of the War. Now, Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times, did even more figuring. It's costing, the war in Iraq is costing us $5,000 a second. Did I misspeak myself? No. $5,000 a second. And he's the first person that I have seen in mainstream society to say this is connected up with the economy and the United States being on the brink, not of a recession, but we're in that, but on the brink of a depression. You know, Japan was in a decade-long depression recession in the 90s. It could happen to us, and when we look back and see why it was, it's going to be right at the doorstep of George W. Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy and his war in Iraq, which now may cost us $3 trillion, which paying that back, I don't know. You ever had like an enormous debt? I know you never have, Jolene, right?
Oh, never.
Never. Which means suddenly when you're trying to make it right, when you're trying to pay off that debt, it means you have money for nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or you're digging yourself in deeper all
the
time.
Do you know how many people can relate to this right now?
Yeah, I think so. And his other article calls Left Was Right, Peace Activists and Their Grassroots. And essentially what he's saying is that everything that the critics said in 2002 and early 2003 was correct. There were no weapons of mass destruction. This wasn't going to be over quickly. We weren't going to be met with the flowers being thrown at our feet. The Iraqis were not going to be able to fund their own war with oil revenues. Everything that the right wing said, everything that the conservatives said was wrong, wrong, wrong.
It was a lie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was a lie, and it was two levels of it. The big conservatives, which are fairly small in number, that represent directly the interests of the wealthy and the corporations that benefit from all this and have benefited from all of it, they lied.
Yeah.
And then the poor, pathetic, I don't know what you'd call them, fodder for their conservative machine just because of, I don't know, resentment and rage and all those kind of negative emotions that they fall in lockstep behind these people who they think are tough.
Oh, yeah.
They may be even tough. I don't know. I guess I don't think of Dick Cheney or George Bush as being very tough.
Yeah, well, what defines tough, right?
Yeah. Another interesting thing in this week's Metro Times was our own Lars Ekstrom.
Yes, and this is a listener of the program.
Who calls in and who has told us.
An ex-Marine.
Ex-Marine, and is a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War. You can go to IVAW.org, and there's a big article on him. There he is, and got his
combat gear, but yeah. next to a sign that says Iraq Veterans against the War. And in fact, we talked, if you're a regular listener of the program, of which we have many, we talked to Lars last week about his trip to D.C.
Yeah, where they had Winter Soldier 2. Winter Soldier 1 took place in 1971 here in Detroit and took testimony from Vietnam veterans. And they told what they had experienced, what they had seen, what U.S. policy against the civilian population was. And this last week, there was much of the same. And if you'd like to call in about this, please do. 313-298-WRIF. But here is an interesting letter that takes first email that came in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com that first takes both of us to task and then takes you, Jolene Jordan.
Ooh.
It's actually a misunderstanding in many ways.
Right.
We were talking about...
I have no problem with being taken to task.
Yeah, okay. We were both talking about how you didn't say what restaurant, but I was talking about how I had eaten at House by You in Ferndale.
Right.
And you were talking about where you had eaten as well. And Deb from Ypsilanti writes in, her subject heading is, good for you too. Now, could you provide suggestions for those of us who do not have health insurance, are losing their homes, cannot find a job after losing their old one. Unemployment has been over 7% in Michigan since 2002. Some of us are hurting, and on and on. Some of us are ready to eat dog food, let alone listen to restaurant reviews. I ask you guys, what are you doing to make a difference? So I wrote back to her. Come on, Deb, give me a break. We can't say where we ate without you claiming we're not making a difference. The ugly fact of life is that some of us are suffering under this system more than others. If all you hear is me and Jolene going to a restaurant and not how we advocate a society of equity, we're not making our views clear, or you're not hearing us very well. Thanks for writing. And I mean, I don't know what to say. I know that people are hurting much more than I am, and that you are.
Yeah.
And
but Deb doesn't know my situation. I don't talk openly about my situation, but I don't have health insurance.
Well, she mistakenly. Well, here, let me read the. Then she writes back, Peter, is there anything you could do to direct the unemployed or inform foreclosure-bound people or even advocate for jobs? If not on the radio, then at Min? Have contacts or ideas to inform on your website or something like that. Cumulatively, I guess hearing how life is good just builds up inside as I hold on by a thread and frantically search for work. I am someone who listens to you to be informed and inspired. However, for instance, when a statement is made like a few weeks ago when Jolene said that she wasn't that concerned about health care because she already had health insurance.
I do not have health insurance.
And you said that.
Yeah. Without.
Yeah.
You know, hoping to have it soon. But, you know, I'm with a lot of you. And so if I you know, no, I have none.
Should I had to listen to the podcast to make sure I heard this right? No, I mean, I distinctly remember you saying you did not have health insurance.
Right.
So I don't know, Deb, if you heard that. And in the last several months, she's announced she has three jobs.
I used to.
Yeah. How nice. And when did she, and when did the show.
Oh, she's mad at me.
And when did the show.
I missed this.
And when she did the show alone, she boasts that you stand up for her no matter what, which isn't true.
No, that's not true.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Jeez. It says, you're definitely right. Some of us are being hit harder, and thus the reason why these things stand out so much. I do hear your advocacy, and I hear what we can do to make our opinion known about the war. Then there's a lot of other things.
Okay.
Well.
Well, you know what? I respect your opinion. Every opinion is welcome through email or on our telephone lines. And I think that really maybe putting the focus more on the wealthy and the people who really do not give one hoot, because I give a big one.
Well, let me just say to Deb and to other people, Jolene and I can do nothing for you directly. I mean, I can't hire you. I mean, could I make a suggestion where you could find a job? Maybe, but that doesn't deal with the aggregate situation of an economy that's spiraling downward, all the while cost of a war keep going upward. And so this is a political question, this is a social question, and it has to be addressed by everyone. And if you're going to depend on me or Jolene, I mean, that's really a thin reed among thin reeds. But even depending upon Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton is a thin reed as well. Because as I've said so many times in this on this program before, the politicians aren't going to do anything unless they are pushed from behind. And if we're not actively pushing in a mass movement the way that American people have always changed history, then it's not going to happen. It's just going to kind of, you know, hang out until this cycle hopefully will go through its downside and eventually come up in 6 months or 6 years or like the Great Depression in 10 years. So you can. All right. So, OK, how do I begin a movement for a society of equity, or how do I begin a movement of the poor, or how do I don't know. I don't know. Sorry. Some right winger wrote me and said, you never know anything. Well, I don't know that. And anybody that tells you they do is a moron, and that ought to be upfront excuse to turn that person off.
Well, yeah, and I think oftentimes people, when you have a political talk show, you're the host of a political talk show, people expect you to have all the answers, but that's not really what this is all about. Sure, we have a lot of great ideas, right, that we feel are great anyway, and I think it's more about educating and about talking about the different issues and kind of hashing some of these things over
more than
anything. We are not here to solve the world's problems by any means.
Well, No.
We'd like to.
Well, I don't know that we could.
Right.
The point is that this is not the arena. This is the arena for information. The arena for action is elsewhere. This is where you can understand that you're in the feelings that you're having about how messed up things are. You're not alone. And hopefully provide some ideas that you can think about. And also through like my website and other websites that are connected to it or similar websites, you can start linking up to things. Now, for instance, on Thursday, March 20th at noon at the McNamara Federal Building in downtown Detroit, there was a demonstration that was demanding that the Housing and Urban Development Department stop foreclosing homes and evicting tenants, and demanding that HUD would impose a moratorium, and demand that HUD help the people instead of the banks. So they're all there for Bear Stearns, but they're not there for people in our neighborhoods that are losing their homes. Now, I don't think too many of you went to it. I didn't go to it. I don't think you went to it, Julian. And, in fact, you know what? I didn't even know about it until after. But this is the kind of activity. The reason that, for instance, that we didn't hear it after, I'll bet you there was 30 people there. If there would have been 300, they probably would have got a little ripple. If there would have been 30,000, it would have been national news.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
And it doesn't take much to go. And I know you're saying, well, how do I learn about these things? Well, sometimes you can go to my my website. But I've got a lot of stuff on my website, and people don't go to it. I mean, there was the fifth anniversary demonstrations on Wednesday, March 19th. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, the corner of 11 Mile and Woodward, there was 50 people. 50 people showed up for that. All right. I mean, at times at that vigil there has been almost 300. But I think in a lot of ways people are just exhausted because they're exhausted by Bushco, by every crime, every misstep, every piece of incompetence, every just insensitive act like Dick Cheney when they ask him, you know, three-quarters or two-thirds of the American people don't agree that we should have gone to war. He says, so...
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think a lot of people feel just extremely helpless, too. Peter,
I know,
you
know. I know. I'm not, listen, I'm not scolding you. I am not, I'm not grabbing you by the lapels. I'm just saying problems can't be solved here. Problems have to be addressed politically and socially. Socially in the sense of creating a social movement. And you say, well, what does that mean? What do I do tomorrow? I don't know.
Like, what go, do I mean, go on 9 Mile in Woodward and...
Oh, I'm actually going to be there tomorrow.
You are tomorrow?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I got to have a little thing in my glass right near. It's terrible to say, but there's a, you know, an eyeglass place right there. Yeah, that sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Well, you know, you're a busy guy.
Well, you know what? It's part of my day.
Fix your protest.
You go to the post office and I get my glasses fixed.
Right.
And
rock on.
Yeah. I mean, there is this sense that I almost do it more to, out of sense of solidarity with the other people that are there.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, we have accomplished what we started off to accomplish in early February of 2003, to change public opinion, to let them back away from adherence to the lies of the Bush administration. Well, that's all been accomplished. Most people do not believe Bush. He's the most ill-thought of president since, I don't know what, Grant or somebody like that, or maybe Herbert Hoover right before the Depression. So we've won the battle of ideas. But what we haven't done, we haven't been able to mobilize that into political action. I mean, these Democrats are, you know, barely worthy of the name opposition party. So we can't depend on them. Well, all right, let me just get back to a movement of the poor, a movement of the dispossessed, the movement of the unemployed, the movement of the working class that is whose standard of living is being eroded, a movement of the middle class who is being looted by all the inflation, by the higher costs of everything. I mean, even if you're job secure, even if you're not hurting, you have less money, your dollar's worth less, all of that stuff, right?
Probably not as much in savings.
Yeah, yeah.
If anything.
Yeah. So you say to me, well, what should I do? Well, I would throw that back at you. What are you going to do? And if you say, I don't know. What the hell? I just go to work every day. I come home. I play with my kids. I'm watching NCAA. What do you expect from me? Well, I don't expect or not expect anything. But I'm saying, I'm just telling you the reality of it. It's not going to change because Obama or Clinton gets into the White House. Things will improve slightly. We will have blocked, you know, we don't want John McCain, you know, more of the same, that's for sure, because that's what we get. This is the guy who wants a 100-year war in Iraq, or 100-year occupation, at least. So the ball's in all of our courts. And if there was a movement that I could say, you know, people, you meet me at the corner, I'd do it. But, you know, that's not my role, and I don't think I can do it. All right. So I don't know. What else is there? There's a number of other things in this. There's a lot of, by the way, a lot of different impact that these that the economy has. The gap in life expectancy has widened. And widened between who? Guess who?
The rich and the poor.
Right. New government research has found large and growing disparities in the life expectancy for richer and poorer Americans, paralleling the growth of income inequality in the last two decades. So this is sort of a Murder Incorporated deal. I mean, nobody who's rich, I know a few rich people, and I'm not talking about upper middle class people, who we often call rich, but I mean, a couple really authentically wealthy people. They're nice people. In fact, they're Democrats. They give a lot of money to the Democratic Party. They think things suck. With them being so rich and people being so poor. So it's not a matter of individuals, although a lot of rich people really are mean and greedy. There's no
there's
doubt
a lot
about
of
that.
Greed, right?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of them, maybe even the majority of them. Some of my best friends are not rich, I would say that. So Murder Incorporated, that was, remember the mafia deal where they would pay people to kill other people? Well, that's essentially what's happening here. If life expectancy for the nation as a whole has increased, according to the researcher, but affluent people have experienced a greater gains, and this in turn has caused a widening gap. The growing inequalities in life expectancy mirrored trends in infant mortality and in death from heart disease and certain cancers. So, let's see. People in the most affluent group could expect to live 2.8 years longer than people in the most deprived group in 1980. By 2000, the difference in life expectancy had increased to 4.5 years. So this is absolutely amazing.
But it also gives some of the reasons. Lower income people, it says, are more likely to live in unsafe neighborhoods. Did you read that part?
Sure.
There?
No. Go ahead.
Lower income people are less likely to have health insurance. Speaking of that, so they're less likely to receive checkup, screenings, diagnostic tests, prescription drugs, and other types of care. Smoking has declined more rapidly among people with greater education and income.
Really?
Yeah, that's what it's, well, this, that's what this article says.
Well, isn't, among some people, smoking is kind of cool again, isn't it?
Is it?
I think so.
I don't know.
Not me. There. Well, one of the things, factors it mentions is infant mortality. Infant mortality means that children that die before the age of 1 year. And the United States is not number one. It's not number two.
We're real bad.
It's not numbered in the first 10. It's not in the first 20.
Right.
It's not in the first 30. This is an indication, an index, by the way, of quality of life, so that all of the European countries, for instance, are pretty far up there. Cuba's number 35, U.S. number 37.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, a lot of this stuff is really interests me, because Cuba has universal health care, so right. Why isn't it much, much lower?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Right. The reason it's so high among in the U.S. is because of the rates of the poor. Like, for instance, six per thousand, per 100,000, that's how many babies die. Six per 100,000 die before they reach the year one in the U.S. In Detroit, it's 17.
Whoa.
So that's almost three times the national average. It would make Detroit number 88 on the list. Number one is Singapore. Number two is Sweden. Number three is Japan. And, again, I'd like to find out about this. Number 22 is our neighbor to the south, Canada.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do I have to say that every week, why it's to the south? Look at your map.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. So these are depressing statistics. By the way, someone said, all you do is say negative stuff. There's a lot of negative stuff going on. You've got non-negative stuff. I want to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And part of the positive stuff. though, going on is the resistance that's beginning to occur. By the way, at 1 a.m., probably be at 1:30 a.m. Eastern time, I'm going to be playing an interview with the director of the Michigan Department Human Resources. Right. I just blocked on it. It's okay.
It happened.
Jolene's eyes got wide. Like, I don't know. You interviewed him. It's my friend, too, Ismail Ahmed. He has like a budget of like $3.5 or $4 billion, and he's greatly concerned about poverty. And later this year, there's going to be a huge conference on poverty in Detroit. And sometimes these are the things that can spark movements. We'll talk more about that as we go along. All right. You can talk more as you go along by calling 313-298-WRIF, email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Oh, yeah, by the way, I just finally posted my photographs of my trip to Cuba in early February on my website. So you can go to Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE.com. I know sometimes you wonder, why do we laugh? Jolene laughed because I have a lot of stuff written down, and it was like I was looking down to see, how do I spell my name? Because I never even remember the numerical 313-298-WRIF.
It's 9743.
I have no idea.
And I don't even have it in front of me.
You don't. But Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE.com. I don't know if they're all self-explanatory, all the photographs, but there they are. A couple of me, even.
Can't wait.
Can't wait. I know you can wait. All right. We'll be right back to get your calls.
Listening, WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you? Hey, it's you and Mike. And Friday morning we were playing Remembering the 80s again. Hilarious game at my expense, of course. This is the game where I try to identify some of the biggest hits of the decade, and the callers had to correctly guess whether or not I'd be able to do it. Oh, boy.
What's up, guys?
What's your selection, sir?
89 and 2.
This could put you over 500 for the day.
Are you serious, Mark?
Yeah. You had too many streaks where you got two in a row, right?
Oh, wow.
Other than that, it's been a total disaster.
Oh, that's spectacular.
Sorry, sir, but you're going out again.
What a spectacular way to set up a miserable failure.
I don't think you'll know this at all.
Oh, Christ.
Chris,
I apologize.
Chris, you say he's going to get it?
Yeah.
You actually have faith in me, Chris.
Sorry, Chris.
I'm trying.
All right, here
all
we
right.
go. Ready?
I appreciate that. I do.
Close your eyes. Give me your hand.
I know this song.
Yeah, sure.
Chris,
what?
You're in luck.
No way.
This song is called Eternal Flame.
Whoa!
I know everything about this song.
Crank it! How on earth,
Chris, dig it.
Bangles.
Get this. This song, back when I was programming.
You can't figure it out.
We're going full circle back to MishCon in the programming computer days, right? Uh-huh. Programmer, system analyst. And we used to go over to Canada every now and again.
Oh,
so anyway,
stripper story?
Yeah. So we were at the Million Dollar Club in Canada, in Windsor.
Yeah.
And of course, when you think about the words, you know, it's like, you know, they're acting it out with this dude. There was this gross guy with a beard sitting in the corner, and this chick is.
What do you mean?
You
feel like close your eyes?
Yeah, close your
hands.
You're right, and she'd take his hand.
Are you kidding me?
You feel my heart beating, and she'd put it between her boobs.
What'd she do
that
for
so
eternal
cheesy.
Flame? She put your hand there.
She showed him the burning STD she had. I ended up walking out of that place loving the damn song, and then sometime after that I heard it on the radio and then heard it again, and then Trish liked it, and all of a sudden one year Trish bought this song. I have this song at home, and that's why I know. So that's the scenic route on that, Chris, but the bottom line is that you won. What a way to go out! Yeah! And that means I'm at the 500, over 500, right?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. What a way, Chris! You and me, bitch!
And seeing how happy this has made you, Mike, I won't even call you a homo for digging this song so much.
He's marching around the studio.
I think it's gay.
Smell the cheap perfume. You see the nude stripper. Picture the creepy guy with a beard and you're there.
Come on.
We're back
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joined by Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Deb criticized Jalene and I for talking on the air about going to what she said were fancy restaurants. Actually, the restaurant isn't that fancy, but it sure is would be expensive to somebody who isn't working.
Yeah, and I'm not going to continue to defend myself, but other than I don't eat out at very expensive restaurants very often at all, and I prefer the Coney, you know?
God. Oh.
I mean, I don't eat the Coney.
Yeah.
But they have
others. They have Greek food and stuff like that. Yeah. William writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If it were not for shows like yours where you've put years of work into many... Wait, what is this? If it was not for shows like yours where you have put years or work into many people would... can't read it. Or many people would not know nothing about the truth. If they choose to bash or find fault, then they need to look at the source, who are the politicians sitting on the soft cushions and the corporate media talking heads and the corporations in general. These are the people, if they can even be called that, who suck the life out of everyone. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right, we agree with that.
For sure.
Let's see here. Here's Mike. Mike's in Birmingham. Hi, Mike. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on WRIF with us.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie A Clockwork Orange?
Yes. Not in a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you recall in that movie, there's a gang member by the name of Alex, and like he was a hoodlum, and he had this gang that hung out with them. They committed some vile acts. They raped some woman, and they killed some person.
Sure.
There's like a guilt, and then Alex gets arrested. He gets reformed, and they use these Pavlovian techniques to like reform him, to like program him against, you know. They programmed him against violent movies, pornography, and music. Those were the three things. And there's a whole culture of kids today that are being raised on violent, extremely graphic violent movies, extremely graphic pornographic DVDs, and extremely graphic like death metal and black metal music. And they're like, we're just living off a culture there's kids that are being raised on like just horrific images of these things, and like they can't be right in the head, you know, like watching this stuff. Like,
I don't know what the overall effect is. I mean, obviously we have an extraordinarily violent society. Long time ago, I can't remember the man's name, a psychologist said that if you use the definition of the United States to describe a person, you'd have someone who would probably be under severe observation or medication or confinement. I mean, we've kind of forget about what we see every day in the news. People commit mass murders, and they don't even make it doesn't even make the news anymore, you know?
I know. It's very scary world in which we it's getting very Orwellian, very Orwellian as time goes by, I guess.
Yeah. Here's just two items. A man who sent a letter to his father indicating he was going to kill his children was found dead with three youngsters in a wooded area in Georgia, California. A son of an auto wrecking yard owner shot four people to death at the business in Santa Maria. Yeah, this is just one day and probably just two items. It's and I don't know. It's indication of a society that's lost its center. And that's when I sometimes talk about if we don't create a movement of renewal, things are just going to get progressively worse. I mean, most of us don't do this. Most of us don't act out. I mean, think about how armed to the teeth this society is, and it's only an infinitesimal minority of people that have access to weaponry that utilize them in a manner that hurts other people. But it's enough so that it creates a problem, an atmosphere of fear, a way that people think when they have a grievance, they go to work with a gun. And like I would say that probably the millions and millions, maybe tens of millions of people that have grievances at work, it's probably only a few dozen, recently at least, that have acted out. You'd say, well, it's a pretty small number. But all of it is small. Even during, as we were saying last week, even during the Depression, the majority of people were working. Today, the vast majority of people are not having their homes foreclosed. But it doesn't take a majority. It takes small percentages either to indicate something that's gravely wrong or a few aspects of a society in terms of economics that just sends us all in a tailspin. All right, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's a Stanley Kubrick film. I was always a little mixed about what the message of the film was. Here's Dave and Howell. Dave, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Yeah, how you doing today?
We're doing good.
Yes, I was thinking about, since you're talking about politics again, which is a subject that always raises my blood pressure.
Well, it is a political talk show.
Yeah.
We tend to talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a few observations I've noticed. I've learned from bitter experience, of course, that when it comes to dealing with politicians, I will always ignore what they say and watch what they do.
There you go.
Because I think that almost all politicians are pathological liars.
Just got done saying this at Easter dinner. Amazing.
Well, the other thing is, though, I'll tell you, Dave, you have to really be... That's not as hard as it used to be, but you almost, in the old days, you had to be almost being an investigative reporter to find out the shenanigans of the politicians. Now it's all out there on the internet, but most people, they're not going to spend a lot of time doing it. I mean, when you go to websites, like for instance, just one, BuzzFlash.com, and you see the unending parade of misdeeds by people in political power, and now it's about 85% the Republicans. We'll see what happens when the Democrats get in, if they don't totally blow it.
Well, I think they already have.
Well, they could.
Like I say, someone needs to remind Nancy Pelosi that impeaching Bush and Cheney is not something for them to consider as an option. It is their, I think it's their duty under the Constitution, and they've abdicated that responsibility.
Well, they have a while ago, and now it's I'm sure too late in the process to even begin it. They stalled and forestalled it, and so it's not going to be an item. All right, Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Jim in Toledo. Jim, thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good.
Okay. I couldn't agree more with that first caller regarding the violence and just, you know, vulgar and bloodshed that goes on today with our youth. But what I'm calling about is, excuse me, have either of you read or talked about the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
You know, I remember seeing that on the New York Times bestseller list, but no, I've never read it. In fact, I don't even exactly remember what the premise is.
Okay. Well, one of the main concepts of the book, actually the most important one after reading it, talks about becoming financially literate. Now, that doesn't mean you know how to read stock quotes on the exchange or, understand what the Dow Jones means on the news. What it means is, in my interpretation, is that you're able to learn how to manage debt and use it as leverage and also obtain or control income sources and not necessarily be a slave to a paycheck or job. And that is one of the things that most of the rich that acquire wealth over their lifetime are able to learn through whatever sources they learn it from, whether it's a mentor who is like a rich dad or, whoever they're able to learn it from. That is something that maybe some of your listeners could benefit from as everybody's going through tough times like I am.
Well, you know what? I guess as a premise, I don't share that. Sure, there are better economic decisions. Some economic decisions that one makes are more sensible than others. A lot of people have outspent their income being bedazzled by advertising and the easy availability of personal credit to the point where they're now, there's a debt crisis, a credit card debt crisis as well that could hit home, shoving us down even further. But again, these are larger social questions. It has to do with how wealth, the total wealth of a society is distributed within it. And it's not done through the market at all, which is what conservatives claim. In fact, it's done through very well-crafted laws, customs, and that comes out in a particular manner. So you have one of the worst disparities of have income in the United States of any of the industrialized countries. So you have, I can't remember the figures, you know, you've probably seen them a lot, like 1% of the top 1% controls more wealth than the bottom 50% and what have you. So people could learn better and better economic skills. No, don't be beguiled by advertising. Don't set your standards on how many commodities you possess. Don't think you have to have the latest everything unless you can afford it, or you're going to get yourself in a jam. Also, read the fine print, which people obviously didn't. They trusted the guy who said, "Hey, you can afford this mortgage," when he was a scam artist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, but I just don't want to put it off on individual responsibility. I mean, there's a tension between social responsibility and individual responsibility. So that the social responsibility to me should be that we're all members of the same society and that we shouldn't have to become, experts in finance or experts in home mortgage, that we ought to be able to trust people around us, that we're not going to live in a society that's so uncontrolled that we have people that are willing to fleece anybody who they can, that can come under their net. We're not going to allow the richest people to become even wealthier at the expense of people lower down the social ladder, particularly the people that are the most helpless. All right, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jerry in St. Clair Shores. Jerry, hi.
Hi, Peter. I just have a counter to the caller that said about the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I think a much better book is a book called Deep Economy,
yeah.
The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. I think it gives a much more accurate accounting of what's going on in the world as far as the economies of scale and things like that that really damage us. And as an example is food production and how it's dependent on oil and done on mass scale to produce profit, where actually a more efficient and productive model is small-scale farming done on a local level. So think things like that are much better economic models under the current conditions of peak oil and climate change than what that other caller was talking about as far as Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Well, it's the same old American ruse, to quote the name of an old song by the MC5, the Detroit Zone, is that it's all the individual. Anyone can make anything of themselves that they want, that you're in this all by yourself, that it's every man for himself and God against all, and what have you. Hey, by the way, just you mentioned peak oil, you're kind of far away from this, but in Southfield on, I can't even read what the date is here, Thursday, April 3rd, I'm going to be moderating a discussion from the Southeast Michigan Sierra Club, and it's going to be at the Northwest Unitarian Universalist Church. There's going to be a film presentation called The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, because, they had the struts pulled out from under them when the Soviet Union left them.
Yes, Megan Quinn Bachman, I believe, is...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But if you go to my website, pardon me, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and go to the calendar page, it'll give you the information.
Yeah, I plan on attending that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. I really hope to be there.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
I'll look for you, Jerry. Thank you so much. Bye now. All right, let's take another caller. Here is Jack in Shelby Township. Hi, Jack, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're good.
I'm back.
Jack?
I just bought a radio at Walgreens.
Well, good.
I've been away from you for about 3 months.
Oh, okay.
Gave my radio away to a poor lady.
Oh, good. That's very generous.
Now, I missed the music, so I went and got one tonight.
That's cool.
But the thing I want to tell you about people, okay, there's two words, frugal and spendthrift. I've been frugal all my life.
Me too.
Never got married, never had no kids. I got a destiny to meet. Destiny.
Yeah.
And it sure as heck isn't playing around playing house with a woman.
Okay.
What is it?
My destiny, I cannot tell you on the radio.
Oh, boy.
Oh no.
We'll talk about that at another time.
Wait. But does it have anything to do with outer space at all?
No, it's got to do with Hollywood.
Okay.
And what I want to tell you basically is the people that call in, my heart goes out to them, but Most of the people I know that are in dire straits right now, it's self-inflicted.
Well, like I say, it's some, it's not, and it depends on who you are. I'm, a white man from a middle-class background, so it's a lot, I've got a lot more latitude in terms of opportunity, in terms of social networks.
Privilege.
All sorts of privileges. You start going down the social scale, you start not being Euro-American, those kind of possibilities erode. Now, within the middle class, you can say, this person maxed out on their credit card, then they bought a house that was way above what they could afford. And suddenly their job get yanked out from under them. Well, even that, even if they were a bit of a spendthrift, you should. Actually, that's what I do. I live low on the hog, so that if the rug gets pulled out from under me, I'll land on my feet. But like I say, that if you're less white, if you're less male, if you're less middle class. I don't know what other little, maybe that's enough right there. The ability to land on your feet, you have less of an opportunity to do it. So if we wind up always throwing it off on individuals, even though individuals often make bad mistakes, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. All right. Thank you very much, Jack. You're back. I'm glad you got
Jack is back.
Jack is back.
And I'll have to say, as a woman, I could be in a really horrible position myself right now. I went through a divorce in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
I lost,
I think that's the first you've announced that.
That's probably the first time I've ever announced it. But I could be in a real bad position. I'm fortunate to have this job here. I get by, but I'm not living high on the hog by any means. And I could have been completely wiped out and, catching a couch somewhere. Sleeping on a friend's couch.
Oh,
yeah.
What the hell that meant. All right.
Not a casting couch.
Yeah. All right. Well, we were mentioning a little earlier Lars from Madison Heights, and here's Lars. Lars, thanks for joining us on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julian.
Hi.
Lars enjoyed seeing you in the Metro Times.
Yeah, they said that I received sniper fire in Kuwait, but I didn't tell them that. Now I know where they got that from.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
I read that, and I was thinking sniper fire in Iraq.
What?
Maybe from his own men.
In Kuwait, he said,
yeah.
I know, but there were some incidents in Kuwait. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty upset the past week that Winter Soldier was almost completely shut out by mainstream American media. I mean, there are just like hundreds of press outlets from all over the world and a lot of independent press outlets, but, not even like BBC did a 3.5-minute story and it was just an interview with one of our members and not even at his home, not even footage of the testimonies.
Let me just, some people may have just joined us. Lars is a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org, and his organization last weekend held hearings with Iraq and Afghan war veterans talking about the war, what they experienced, what they did, what policy was, and a number of other aspects relating to the conflicts. And usually I'll tell you, I have to say, Lars, that I'm shocked you're shocked. It's just par for the course, actually.
I mean, we had one Marine actually had video of his company firing unprovoked on a mosque. It's on YouTube all over the place, but they're just, you could subvert people's like, well, there might have been terrorists there. Well, they're not shooting at the platform at the top. They're shooting up and down the sides, and then after they've gone out with machine guns, they have a tank fire at it. And it's like, okay, how is that possibly... I mean, are they bulletproof terrorists inside?
Yeah. Well, I don't think we can depend on the mainstream media to report much of what interferes with their masters' game plans. And
it is frustrating, though. We talk about that a lot when we go to these big protests in D.C. and then nothing.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, you were.
They don't have, that's not news in many ways to them. I would imagine that I could see them like putting a 30-second clip on. The way they often have a 30-second clip. They don't even do that anymore, but they used to have like a 30-second clip. 500,000 people would show up in Washington, D.C. to say the war sucks, and they would have like 30 seconds on it. And they would say, well, we covered it. What do you expect us to do? Have the speeches? Oh, no, of course not. All we want you to have is the continuing one-note song from the administration, which, not a lot of the media outlets have gotten critical of the war in Iraq. Now that, of course, it's way too late, they could could have provided that role in order to have stopped this war from ever occurring. But they were the cheerleaders of it. Even things like National Public Radio. What do we used to call it? Nationalistic Pentagon Radio.
That's right.
At end of 02 and the beginning of 03.
I sent you an email with a copy of with a link to my testimony video, and as well as pictures of my MySpace page. Because I see what you meant about there when there's like the half a dozen counter protesters outside.
Yeah, you had some protesters.
Yeah, there was they were agitating or like calling us pussies or not patriotic.
Whoa, they really know how to hurt a guy, don't they?
Oh, they are so mean.
It's like, I don't know how. It's like the idea, like, we support the troops. We just won't pay higher taxes or endure rationing or give them the gear you need or let you come home, but we support you.
Or go themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every once in a while, we'll get some young guy on here that'll, I don't think in months and months, but he'll say, I support the war in Iraq. And I say, well, hey, man, Monday morning, go down to the recruiting office. You can, you can be right in it. Well, I'm finishing college, you know. We're behind you. Way, way behind you. Lars, I got to take a break right now. But I will put, I will put your direct link. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. I already have a link to all the testimonies, but since you're a faithful listener and caller to the Night Call show, I will I'll put a separate link right to your testimony. So thank you, and
keep on keeping on, Lars.
That's right. All right. All right. Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is WRIF.com. The boys of summer are getting ready down in Lakeland.
Now, it's time for you to get pumped for your 2008 Detroit Tigers. 101 WRIF is your ultimate Tigers baseball ticket connection. With your chance to win tickets to every home game, your Detroit Tigers play in the month of April. Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Wear for your chance to instantly win a custom WRIF opening day t-shirt. One lucky riff winner will score an incredible grand prize. You just might win tickets to every Detroit Tigers home game in the month of April. You won't just be the envy of your friends. You'll be the biggest Tigers baseball fan in the Motor City. The Riff ultimate ticket could be yours. Listen and win from 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. I like it.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me. And at 1 a.m., I'll be having two guests, one right up at 1 a.m. Actually, I'll have one guest at 1 a.m.
You'll have one guest at 1 a.m. and one at 1:30.
That's right. Tamara Trout, both of these fit into what we're talking about. She has written the foreword to a book called Up to Our Eyeballs, How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt. And again, so this is not the individual, but rather how aspects of policy and aspects of behavior that is allowed unregulated. I mean, you can't have capitalism and allow it to be unregulated, because look at the 19th century. That's the way it would be without regulation. We, the working class, now let me, you know, the working class, is that guy some kind of weird commie talking about the working class? It was all the working, it was only the owners and the working class, and a very, 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 very tiny, like middle class. But because of unions and because of years of political and social and economic struggle, actually created a middle class in this country. And it's not still not that large, not an enormous one like there is in European countries. And that's beginning to fray around the edges. Now, Ismail Ahmed, who is the director of the state of Michigan
Human Resources
Department. I'm just looking at the errors I made here on my website. Folks, I depend on you to tell
to
me.
To correct you once
this
in a while.
This is Ismail Ahmed, Director, State of Michigan Director, Department of Human Resources. Okay, anyways, they're both very interesting. If someone told me the director of the Department of Human Resources was going to be on a talk show, I don't think I would listen. But I wouldn't have him on unless he was interesting and filled with information. Also, it's a guy I know. It's an old pal of mine. So, lately, I'm having only old pals on my
show. You have a lot of pals.
Yeah, yeah. 313-298-WRIF. And here, let me get the name of the person here. Didi says, I was on Hall Road yesterday at 3 p.m. First, you would never believe gas is over $3 a gallon with all the traffic. Second, the parking lots at all of the strip malls, Lakeside, Partridge Creek Mall, including all the restaurants peppered in between, were completely full. There were lines hanging out into M59 just to enter the lots. Who are these people with all the money able to dine out and shop? I'm struggling not even paycheck to paycheck, but day to day, and can barely afford basics, let alone casual shopping. I realize these businesses employ people as well, which is fantastic, but you'd never believe this was Michigan during this recession. Thanks for your show. Now, we've said that as well, right?
Well, that really was how this whole thing about you, where you and I had had dinner separately, but it was actually the same restaurant. And that's what I was saying to you. You know, I looked around and I said to my mate who I was having dinner with, you know, you would never know looking around here that there is, you know, a whatever you want to call it, recession.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
Hard times.
You start to look in some of the suburbs and stores are starting to close. I agree with you. I sometimes go places and I'm thinking, recession? What recession?
Mm-hmm. You know? Right, right.
But let me see. There were a couple of other emails I wanted to quickly read. Oh, yeah. Jamie from Kingsville, Ontario writes, he went to my website, peterwerby.com, and saw the Cuba photos that I put up there. He said, stunning profile similarity with Christopher Columbus, Pete. Hey, Jalene.
Hey.
That is a photo that in a city called Baracoa. In Cuba, which is the second place that Columbus, when he was discovered by the native people.
Right.
Second place where he went to in 1492. And so there's one, him looking out to sea, and I just sort of posed in the same
way. I haven't seen that one. I need to spend some quality time with your Cuba photos, for sure.
Oh, really? Well, I'll put one up when I, just here so you can see it.
Okay, good.
You get a chance. But let me see. One more email, and then we'll go back to our phones. Hello, hello. Oh, well, I think I blasted off.
That's actually a line from Clockwork Orange.
What?
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello. Really? That's what that is? Yeah. That's sort of just British in general, isn't it? All my English friends.
I don't know.
Hello, hello, hello.
I remember it from the movie.
Yeah, well, yeah. Here's Matt in Dearborn Heights. Matt, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Peter? How you doing, Jalene?
Good.
Hey, Matt.
I don't normally listen to your show. I'll listen every once in a while if I'm in the car, and I find a disturbing trend, and I heard you say this, and I had to call in. I guess I'm just sick of the white guilt and the people that you espouse. I'm a white male. I mean, Should I have some guilt because I'm white, Peter?
I don't think so. I sure don't.
Well, I don't understand.
Wait. Before we back up, that's not what I'm talking about. And that's definitely, if you look to Barack Obama's speech, he was talking about that not being the case either, that a lot of us are all in the same boat. African-American people, people of African ancestry, suffer worse in the economy in general and in every downturn. So is that something that you and I should feel guilty about? No, but is it something that we should feel responsible for? I would say, yeah, just as we should be feel a sense of responsibility for the 50 million people that don't have health insurance.
Yeah, what about compassion?
Yeah.
Just having compassion.
Well, no, I don't know that Matt does not have that, but Matt is saying, should we feel guilt? No, guilt never gets you anywhere. That's not what it's about. What we should be about is authentic change.
That's what it's about. Absolutely, that's what it's about.
What's what about?
Do exactly what you're espousing.
What?
I mean, as I turn the corner, I didn't have my college education paid for. I certainly didn't grow up like the Brady Bunch. I mean, and the way that you come off is just absolutely ridiculous. How about what is wrong with self-responsibility?
What is wrong with
for anybody?
Self-responsibility.
That's good. And a lot of people have it. And a lot of people have self-responsibility, and they work and they work and they work, and they can't get anywhere. Because there's a class system here that essentially is a caste system. That
Just like India.
Yeah, that allows some upward mobility. But mostly we live in an era where the ultra-wealthy have gotten wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And middle class or working class people like you, however you define yourself, work your butt off, and your overall income is eroded while the wealthy they're just cruising.
You know, big corporation, corporate America. I do believe in somewhat of that, but I do believe that there's still for the individual, anyways.
There's what?
For the individual.
Yeah.
For the individual. There's got to be some self-responsibility here.
Well,
and then
yeah.
The gentleman that you're going to have on now, and I'm not saying that's him, I just kind of find it very funny that in one of Bin Laden's speech to some of the terror network, he said we need to know the American banking system as well as we know the palm of our hands and the lines in the palm of our hands. And if you don't think that they don't have something to do with some of the things that have transpired, you're sadly mistaken, Peter.
You sort of lost me. Wait. You sort of lost me with the Osama bin Laden thing. Where did that come from?
Where did that come from? That came from a speech.
No. I mean, why did you bring that up?
What does this have to do with our white privilege conversation?
Well, white privilege? Who said white privilege?
Well,
that's how I define it. I said I'm white and I'm not privileged.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Fine. But then all of a sudden we're talking about that and you start talking about Osama bin Laden and the banking system. I'm sort of where did that come from?
System, because some of the problems that are occurring is that right now, economically, within the banking system, is due partially to the terror network that has infringed upon our banking system.
Well, I doubt if that's true. In fact, right now, because of George Bush, where the terrorists come from, particularly the 9/11 terrorists, Saudi Arabia, they're financing this country. Why do you think Cheney's over there? Why do you think Bush goes over there? They go over there, and one of two things. Either they're begging them to lower the price of oil by pumping more out, or they are telling them to keep it up so the Saudis will keep making more profit and then be able to finance the debt of this country by continuing to buy treasury bonds and invest in this country. But I don't think Terror Network has anything to do with it. But thank you. I appreciate it, man.
I do think that the government is spending a whole lot of money trying to, quote-unquote, fight terrorism. We can say that, right?
What? Sorry, I kind of blanked out. But never mind.
Let's take our next call.
Here's Skip in Detroit. Skip, hi. It's Peter and Jalen.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
I'm just calling about people wanting to know what to do.
Yeah.
To fix everything.
Yeah.
We need people that are unemployed and stay-at-home moms to become a hub to talk to organizations, clubs, Boy Scouts, senior citizen clubs, to get together and ask them all when's a good time to go down and protest all this, to demand that gasoline by law can only be sold for $1 a gallon at the pump during the recession.
Well, Yeah.
So what you're saying is leave it up to the women? All right, we'll take it on.
Well, he said unemployed, too. Yeah, but I guess, Skip, and tactically that could be something that could work because most of us will still be going to jobs. People that are not at the work every day could play an important role, but what's got to coalesce is actually that movement or that organization. If you go back and study the history of the 1930s, well, that was a lot about unions. But there are also parallel community support organizations that that bolstered the union demands for, you know, better wages and protection and even just the right to organize. And that's not here yet. And you can't just will it into being. I can't will it. You can't will it. And that's why we don't, most of us, 99% of us, don't have anything to do tomorrow. I mean, it would be good, for instance, since the war is tied directly to the miserable state of the economy. I mean, when you're spending $5,000 a second on the war, it means that you have to go into debt. It means that there's not money for social programs. For instance, what if that price of oil was actually legitimate? Which I don't think it is for a minute. The government, for instance, could subsidize gasoline, not to the companies, but to the individuals, could pass out a stipend. We're talking about $1 trillion a year that's going down the rat hole of the budget for preparation for war. We literally could be reduced by 75%, we could ameliorate a tremendous amount of our problems, if not all of them, if we got off of the military-industrial complex economy. Okay, Skip, thank you. Here is Private J. Private J, does this mean, is that your rank, or are you just a private person?
Private second class, U.S. Army. Sir, how you doing today?
Hi.
Yeah, I'm just calling in because, you know, I heard this guy talking on the radio about how it's hard and he works and it's, the classes aren't the same. Well, yeah, that's unfortunately life, but you got to look at it as, hey, you're waking up every day. You're taking a breath. You're living your life. It's how you make it is what happens. I mean, people don't know what it's like to be a soldier. I mean, and it's their choice. And it's my choice, and I am right now myself. I'm home for Easter. I'm happy, you know? I mean, I wake up and I see, I get 5 hours of sleep a week. I'm not even gonna lie, you know?
A week? A day? A night?
No, when we're out in the field, you know, training, you know, sleep's a crutch. You ain't gonna need it, really, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more life on the lines of staying awake and alive.
Wait a minute, let me just go back to your statement about how the people join the armed services willingly. Tell us, Private J, why you joined.
I honestly joined, I'm not gonna lie, but to jump out of some planes. But it eventually grew into some more, you know, intriguing things. College, there's, I don't wanna be cliche, but defending your country on that. And it's just knowing that, you know, I'm 18 years old. I'm able to take care of myself and live my life, and I'm dependent. I'm dependent on myself. I'm not, you know, living off my parents or my grandparents or whoever you would be. I mean, it makes you into the man or woman that you want to be for the rest of your life.
Well, let me say this. The desire for adventure, I'm sure, is a great motivator, and I'm sure patriotism is a great motivator as well for a lot of people that join. But in there, when you talk about a college education, I would suspect that if everyone had, for instance, if there was a, like they have in some countries, free college education. I mean, why does college education cost money? Why does it cost thousands, tens of thousands, so that now when if you take out loans, you exit college owing $250,000, or in some cases, if you go to advanced studies, you know, medical school and all that, even more. So there is the coercion of economics even there among the soldiers. Like if everything was available, that should be available as both as ways to advance oneself in a career, and also that the social safety nets were there. You probably have enlistment fall off by about two-thirds or something like that. All right, Private J, thank you. Stay safe. Let's, hopefully that this war will end soon. Okay. Let's see. Let's take our next caller. There we go. I was wondering what was happening. I was pushing buttons and nothing would happen. Here's Lon in Fenton, Michigan. Lon, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF.
Hello, Peter. Hi. I know it's mostly a political show, but since it started out with the social commentary on a Kubrick film, I wanted to make a little comment on that myself. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Waiting for you.
Okay. You've got to understand why society's doing it like it is. I mean, take a look at it. This is what people want to see. They don't just pick things and throw them on the air or this or that. They want to see violent stuff. They want to see it. That's what's getting the ratings, or that's not what would be on. If everybody wanted to see love stories, that's what would be on television. That's what they would be playing for music. That's what they would be, you know, showing. We want the violence. Why? I don't know. It's not my thing, but it's just a fact.
You noticed how much, how many movies now have the most grisly, graphic torture in them?
Unbelievable!
I don't watch them. I don't watch any of them.
Yeah. I don't. I'm not a fan of them either. But the fact is, that's what the people want to watch. So if you turn around and say that's the reason that this stuff's happening, I can't believe it. This is what the public wants to watch. I mean, if you looked at the news 20 years ago. If there was a shooting or something, they would show maybe the building where it happened. Now they show you the blood stains on the ground, and because this is what the people want to see.
Oh, yeah. I was a television news reporter for about 5 years, and we could not leave that scene until we got the shot of the dead body coming out. You know, covered, of course, but that gurney, we had to have that gurney. We could not leave the scene of drowning until that body was recovered.
Well, so here, this staid old pillar of American journalism, the New York Times, frequently they have on their front cover people that have been killed in bomb attacks or often violence in other parts of the world, like Iraq and what have you. And I'm thinking how obscene this is that we get this delivered. And there is somebody who was somebody's sister or brother or father or kid or something like that. This mutilated dead body is on the cover of a newspaper that then you open up. Well, you open up and then there'll be some other tragedy on page three. And always on the top right-hand corner of page three, there's an ad for Tiffany's.
Tiffany's for a $50,000 ring or something, right?
Starting at $50,000.
Right,
starting at $50,000. Yeah. Lon, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number here. And here's Dan in Detroit. Dan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah,
you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing? This is my first time calling.
Welcome.
And I usually listen to your rock and roll station, but never the talk your station, but I happen to be channel surfing, and I caught on to a couple of your guests here talking.
Good, thanks.
And I never heard anybody mention Ron Paul.
Okay. Oh, you've missed many shows then.
Yeah, we've talked about it for Ron.
What you got?
I might have.
Okay.
I've never heard anybody mention Ron Paul, and he's still in there.
Yeah, he is. So is it just him and McCain?
Well, no. Let's get on this oil thing that I'm talking about here. You have to listen to this guy named Lindsey Williams, and he's at LW.com, LWOil.com. Now, I heard this guy. He's a brilliant guy. He's from Alaska. And what I heard him say is, I don't know which oil company, but they tapped an oil well in Alaska. Supposed to be one of the biggest in the world, besides one in Iran. I think Iran has another big one, just as big.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not releasing that oil until it reaches $150 a barrel.
Huh. Well, I don't know if it works exactly like that. I mean, there's they could release enough oil now that the gasoline that it could go down to $25 a barrel. They control. There's obviously no free market in oil, and you would think that the great free market advocates, all these conservatives led by Bushco, Bush Incorporated, they would say, let the market, it's like diamonds. It's like De Beers diamonds. They control how many diamonds are out there. Like we just mentioned the ring at Tiffany's. If it was a diamond ring and all the diamonds were sold that were out there, it'd probably be worth about $10,000. So it's a controlled market, and so is oil.
Well, that could make us independent from foreign oil, from what I hear. And that could bring, in less than a year, it'll bring us down to $1.50 a gallon.
Well, one of the things we need to do is just think about, that'd be good. That'd be good for starters. But, well, you know what? Let me back up. And I just say this, I'm saying this off the top of my head. Maybe it's not good. Maybe restrict it. Maybe let it go. Ooh, this would, and hear me out before everybody starts screaming at me. $4 or $5 a gallon, and then we'll start to say, wait a minute. Maybe we ought to go back to concepts that are 100 years old. Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, who wanted to build electric cars, not internal combustion cars like Ford finally wound up making. It's a long, long story why that happened. Maybe we should do what Edison said and have, he was talking about wind generators at every single house in the United States, or that every new house had to have both a windmill and solar panels on the roof, that it was mandated by a national building code. You say, wait a minute, where's the money going to come from? Take it from the war in Iraq. Get the troops out now. That's what Ron Paul says, right?
That's right. That's what he said. But I think it's the oil companies stopping this alternative energy from happening.
Oh, you bet.
It's got to be them.
You bet. You bet. You absolutely are right. They could wind up to be manufacturers of solar panels or something like that. But why bother? The hundreds of billions of dollars keep rolling in. They have access to power. They are, in fact, the direct representatives in the case of Bush and Cheney, direct representatives of oil. And everything is just sweet on their end of things. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. I was at a meeting, the Iraq Moratorium Against the War, which is, I think, iraqmoratorium.org, that has an event all around the country the third Friday of every month. So this was just last Friday. And there was somebody there from the Libertarian Party, which Ron Paul one time was a presidential candidate. And they left a piece. This is interesting. Ron Paul says, no taxes on tips.
Really?
Yeah, right now. He says it's an outrage that waiters, waitresses, and other service sector employees have to pay taxes on tips that they earn. Your tips should be good for service, not for the federal government's pockets. Currently, the IRS taxes tips based on what they estimate workers will make, whether or not they actually make that amount, which is, anybody that works in food industry will tell you. And the tip tax now, and he's introduced a bill, which is very cool. And he also says, as many of you know, he wants to end the IRS and the income tax. I don't know how the hell they expect to
make that happen.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how they expect to make it happen. I don't know. How do they finance government without that? Because what I think that the income tax ought to be eliminated on the vast majority of American people, and it ought to be paid by the people that can well afford it, in which there is enough, particularly if you stop military expenditures to the extent that it is. You could have, you could do that.
Cut people some slack, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I don't think he's going to get the nomination.
I'm just guessing, no.
Maybe he's thinking something will happen to McCain or something like that. But they're both up in their 70s, right?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, good. Good. Get our elders in on this. here is Darius in Hamtramck. Hi, Darius. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Just a question. I agree with the last caller about whatever he said. Just want to bring one point up. It is very difficult, to make a living with the wages and everything like that. You know, I don't understand why people, like, for example, whenever there's a price increase in France or anywhere in Europe, people get together, they boycott things, and over here, whenever they raise prices on anything, gas, electric, natural gas, to heat your homes, nobody stands up. There is not even an iota of any revolt of the price increase. Why people stand up over there? Why do they gather up and make things happen? Can you explain that?
Well, no, it must be, you know, there was a psychologist from years and years ago named Wilhelm Reich, who was Sigmund Freud's favorite student at first. And he talked about a mass culture of submission, that it's inculcated, it's bred into us by all sorts of social institutions to be passive, to not respond, even when we're being hurt. I mean, there's a lot of tough men in American society. A lot of guys, I mean, you look at them wrong, they want to fight. Brave men and women that are doing everything from serving in the armed forces to fire departments, and I can't even think of all the kind of brave acts that go on a daily basis. And yet, when it comes to taking on the government, you're right. They don't do it. And part of it is, like I say, I'm not being critical. I'm not being critical of the individual who is not taking action tomorrow, because the great powers that be have also have been able to weed out of society the social mechanisms or the social agency for making those protests known. One of the things you'll probably notice in Darius, if you read closely into the accounts of protests against prices in Europe or Asia, other places, Africa, they're almost always led by one of two groups, unions or political parties. Well, unions have purposely been attacked so relentlessly, and some of them have gotten fat and lazy and satisfied with the way things were, the upper leadership. And the other thing is the political parties in a lot of different countries will lead these activities. So they'll call that. So if you're a member of the Socialist Party in Italy, and they do something, they send out to their millions of members, get out to the street. Well, I mean, listen, the election was stolen from Al Gore in 2000, and what does he do? He goes to the commander-in-chief's inauguration. So congratulations. What does that tell you? All right, thank you very much, Darius. But it's a question that has always intrigued and plagued me, for sure. Let's see. Here is Ripple Red. Ripple?
Yeah, it's Little. Just wanted to tell you that I think that you sort of took the words out of my mouth there, because I was thinking about Darius and what he was saying, and it seemed to me that what he was getting to, you got to it for him. He was asking, how come when there's a price increase in Europe, they're out in the streets? And I think the big reason is they got unions over there, got mass unions.
Yeah.
That is a big deal there, and I think that we need to take that into consideration. But the other thing that I wanted to raise was that I think that we have to build resistance institutions at the grassroots. What I mean there is, if you look at the way we all live, I mean, I live in one house. There's just me, and that's it. And in the first place, you're lonesome when you do that. And the second place, you're kind of demobilized. You're kind of taxes, they're paying the mortgage. There's only you, and all this kind of deal can really bring you down, and it can also bring you to a position where you just don't do anything, right?
Sure.
So I would advocate that people go back to the communal sort of style of life. It's more efficient. It's in terms of heat that you got to pay for. It's more efficient in terms of grocery shopping. It's more efficient. The whole thing's a good way to live. And the times that I've had the most politically active life has been the times when I've lived in collective living situations. I just wanted to raise that.
Wow. All right, Ripple Red, thanks for joining us on Night Call. 313-298-WRIF.
Well, it has gotten to the point where there are a lot more families living together.
Yeah,
more.
not by choice, though.
Right.
I just saw there was a lead story in Yahoo News about how 50-year-olds are moving back with their parents. Yeah. Hey, caller would like you to give out. This is from Al Slayer, answering the phones at 313-298-WRIF. Please give out the info again for that Ferndale action tomorrow. This is a vigil in Ferndale at the corner of 9 Mile and Woodward. It goes from 4:45 to 5:45 every Monday. It's got an interesting aspect. People were holding up signs saying "honk if you're against the war." And one of the guys with a sign was arrested for, I don't know what, encouraging noise or something like that. Well, he had a big trial, and actually it was a small trial.
He won.
And he won. That's right. So now people are out there, and man, the horn honking is loud. But one of the things you can do, go to my website. I've said more on my website this show than I think in the past five shows. You go to Peter Werby, and someone said, you spell it every time. It's because people don't know my name. They think it's Worthy. They think it's what, a million things.
Yes.
W-E-R. PeterWerby.com. Go to the calendar page, go over on the right, and you'll see, I don't know, I think there's about six or seven weekly vigils against the war. And you can, you know, it's a non-threatening, family-oriented place where you can hook up with people that are taking action. And I'll tell you, some of them have, like, and they feel good when there's 50 people, sometimes as many as 300, but that ain't nothing. If, I mean, there's tens of thousands of you listening just in the Detroit area here. And if a fraction of that came out to Ferndale tomorrow, for instance, and put like 1,000 people on that street corner, I'll tell you, there's never any media there. So, you wouldn't, probably wouldn't.
Maybe someone would call the media, though.
Yeah, I'd say there's 1,000 people on the corner all saying, end this war, take care of us. You know, turn the economy around, or if that began a regular feature in Ypsilanti and Rochester, in Gross Point, I'm trying to think where the other ones are, in Royal Oak, if those started getting not like a few dozen, not even a few hundred, but a few thousand, well, then something would happen. So there's something you can do, but why do I think the 99.9% of you aren't going to do it? And I try to raise my voice nicely at the end because I'm not saying you're a bad person.
Right.
I'm not saying that you're irresponsible or remiss in your duties as a citizen. But I'm saying that ain't nothing going to happen unless we get active. And don't depend on others and don't depend on politicians.
Oh, that for sure to that one.
Yeah. All right. We'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
Hey, it's Joe Mike. Enjoy your Easter weekend. We'll see you Monday morning with Stacy. She was just dumped off The Bachelor. She's that psycho skank that put the panties in his pocket, which horrified him. Also Monday, we'll talk with actor, wacko environmentalist Ed Begley Jr. I mean, this guy is a nut job. He generates all of his own power, lives in this really weird house. Hollywood thinks he's half nuts. What a tightwad. Plus Monday, we'll have more of your calls to our riff bitch slash comment line. To get involved, go to DrewMike.com, grab the phone number, and participate. And ladies, be listening for our new contest called Body Part Brackets for cash prizes and to automatically be in the running to be the new 28 Riff Rock Girl, all right? Details Monday with us, Joe and Mike, in the morning on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Yeah, all right, I'll see you guys there.
Joe and Mike, weekday mornings on the Riff. No subscription necessary. 101 WRIF. Everything rocks.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Personality. I know your anger. I know your dream.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final half hour. Jillian Jordan is with me. That last ad, I think that was the massive pipes of somebody used to be the production director here at WRIF,
yes.
Dave Lee.
Yeah. Big pipes.
And he used to listen. Dave, if you're listening, hey. 1 o'clock, join me as I interview Tamara Trout, co-author. Actually, she's not co-author. She wrote the foreword to Up to Our Eyeballs, How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt, and also Ismail Ahmed, the director of the Michigan State Department of Human Resources. Also on my site, peterwerby.com, there is my photos from my Cuba trip. And also right below it, you can hear the Jillian Jordan interview with me about the Cuba trip that I made. So it all makes sense. It makes some sense to listen to it. So, you know, and some of you, know, you look
you
at
can the, understand
well,
a
like
little
nice,
more about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, nice photo, but you know, what the
but
hell
why?
Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to our phone. Some open lines for the first time in a while. 313-298-WRIF. And here is Joey. Joey, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Oh, I wanted to actually talk to you about the influence that people are saying that, like, movies and stuff are having on teens nowadays. And
sure.
Yeah, violent images.
Yeah, I mean, like, I kind of agree with it, but then I kind of don't because, I mean, yes, there are being movies made like this, but, I mean, that can really show you that, you know, these situations can occur, and what would you do if you were in this situation?
What? I mean, if some big monster attacks you, you got to whip out your magic sword?
No, not like that. I'm talking more realistic situations.
All right. If you if you're attacked by assassins, pull out your Glock and put 14 shots in them?
No, something easy. Like if you were to get jumped, like at a corner of a street or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that could show you, you know, what is the right thing to do and what to expect.
Well, I think I'm going to opt for the self-defense course.
Yeah. What do you think? Well, what have you learned if you got jumped by three guys? What would you do?
Basically, I've learned to basically just see the signs of before things would happen.
Run.
Well, yeah. Sometimes you got to do it. I didn't I ever tell you my little mantra? What I do if I'm confronted with the possibility of violence? Talk. Walk, run, tai chi, karate, shoot.
That's the order.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. And someone said, you're going to run away? You're damn right. You know what?
As fast as I
can. Yeah, I know a lot of you guys have been in fights, but you know what happens when you get in fights? Even if you win, you, like, mess up your hand and all that. You know, never mind. I'm going
don't back. Mess with the face.
Dude. Yeah, like that. So you want to, I mean, if you can't, if I mean, I got to say, you know, all of my life, I mean, I've lived in tough neighborhoods and things where what you're saying, Joey, that I learned by street smarts, by knowing you just somehow you can see the look in somebody's eyes. I certainly didn't get that from television. And, in fact, I'll tell you a story. Joey, hey, thanks for your call.
Pepper spray.
There you go. We were in the Cuban, my friends and I were in the Cuban city of Holguín at the beginning of February. And we went to, and there's a photograph of this, this Trova, T-R-O-V-A, type of music, Trova Center in Holguín. And we went there, heard this wonderful group playing this Cuban music. And then we get out, and boo, Holguín is closed down. So there's no public transportation. Our bus had left, and, I mean, we suppose we could have walked. We're about 2.5 miles from our hotel. But, you know, we've been, you know, that country is famous for rum, right?
Now, mojitos.
Yeah. Mojitos, yeah. So we started looking around. Where can we get a cab? No cab. And some guy says, I'll drive you, which is illegal. It's illegal anywhere to have unlicensed cab. You can't. Like, for instance, you cannot, if you saw somebody, you can't. All right, forget it. All right, so we're in.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah, we're in Holguín.
You can't just start a taxi business.
Yeah, right. In the United States, and you can't do it in Cuba either. So this guy's saying, okay, come with me. So there's about four of us, I think there was, or maybe even five. And so he's taking us down this dark street. I'm going, oh, no, bad idea. But it's not like that in Cuba. It was fine. This guy, we wound up getting a ride back to our hotel in a 57 Ford Fairlane.
Sweet.
Right? And we each gave the guy a peso, which, so that was about $4 or $5, which, for the Cuban economy, that's,
he did well.
Yeah, for 2.5 mile
Sadly
ride.
Enough,
but the point being is that all of my alarm bells weren't necessary there, but they are, they're necessary around here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. Here is Nick. Nick is way up in North Branch. Nick, thanks for joining. Are you listening to WRIF on the radio or?
I'm on the radio driving down the road.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. You're
here. Yeah, got you loud and clear.
Good.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of things, but I guess in response to the guy before this, I mean, if he's worried about what people are watching in movies and kids, I mean, ultimately, there's a lack of parental guidance in this country and family values, and if you want to know what your kids can watch and understand from, they need to be instilled with better values. But
well, let me just respond to that because I forgot I was going to mention this to him. Half of American children have televisions in their bedroom, and one study says third graders have as many as 70%. And everything, children with bedroom TV score lower on school tests and are more likely to have sleep problems. Having a television in the bedroom is strongly associated with being overweight and a higher risk for smoking.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe it.
I never had a television in my bedroom growing up. But I'll tell you what, sometimes parents, it really is out of their control. For example, I probably started babysitting when I was, 12 or 13. And when I was that age is when I saw the A Clockwork Orange for the first time.
Really?
As a young girl, because I was babysitting at someone's house who had Cinemax. So
yeah.
You can't control your kids all the time.
Right.
But I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, not they were just controlling them, but I grew up younger watching, I've seen some other movies too, but it's all, it's just basically understanding you can't take everything for what you believe, but that's about the movies. But I did have a question to ask,
sure.
Though. I was talking about this with a friend the other day. In order for a third party I know that they don't really get funding from the government like the Republicans, Democrats do. Isn't there a certain amount of votes or percentage of votes they can get in an election to get that?
Well, they can get federal matching funding, and I don't know. I don't know whether like Ron Paul has risen to that level or not.
Right.
But even if he has, it's nowhere what's necessary to compete
right.
with the big money that's going on the big three candidates.
Yeah, I understand. I was talking to Bugs. It was just obviously. I vote, I register, I follow politics, I'm into it, but, I personally think the biggest problem with the election process and all politics and all is that it's just such a rut. It's either right or left, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, and I think that's one big root of the problem there is that it's, when you go to a vote, it's okay, well, who's the lesser of two evils here?
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the biggest problems.
Like in 2000 and 2004 was the evil of the two lessers.
Right.
<That's>
Yeah, you are right too.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. Yeah, keep on checking it all out. This was an extraordinarily interesting piece that I saw on Reuters, the news service. Now, Hillary Clinton, remember her? I mean, she's like disappeared almost.
Well, actually, she's up in the polls. She took a lead over Obama.
Well,
but that's
what
Gallup
I saw.
Poll, right?
Yeah, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has moved into a significant lead over Barack Obama among Democratic voters, according to a new Gallup poll. Now, I can't believe that any polling service would actually be so influenced by the politics of its owners that they would distort it. But Gallup has become very, very right wing. This is absolutely extraordinary. It's actually to the point of unbelievability to me. Clinton, they say, has 49% approval among Democrats, 42% over Obama. Now, also, this contradicts most other polls. Gallup said polling data also showed McCain leading Obama 47% to 43%, and where is it? And edged Clinton 48% to 45%.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, you also have a theory on this, though.
I do?
Well, you sent me an email, and you said, is it possible because Gallup is a right-wing organization that they want to uplift Hillary because they think they have a better chance of McCain beating Hillary than Obama.
Yeah, they actually show in their survey that Obama loses worse to McCain, but that doesn't that is contrary to all sort of prevailing opinion.
Yeah.
One of the things that's happening too is that Rush Limbaugh and Laura, I can't even think of her name. Want to give her the publicity.
A right-wing radio host.
Yeah. They are encouraging. Talk about distorting the democratic process, which they have absolutely no respect for. I mean, no conservative has. They talk all this crap about you know, respecting the Constitution, and they violate it all the time. And they, well, the rank and file don't, but they support the violators of the Constitution continually. But in these swing states like Pennsylvania that Limbaugh and his pal have been urging, Republicans since it's a far gone conclusion that McCain is going to beat Ron Paul in the Pennsylvania primary,
yeah,
that they've been urging their supporters to switch parties and vote for Hillary Clinton.
Really?
Because they think that Clinton will be the easier of the two to beat.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Okay, let's continue onward. Here is Mark. Mark is in Sterling Heights. Hey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. Good evening, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to segue into the submissive culture that's being, you know, propagated in today's society. And the word government actually means in Latin mind control. And
wait a minute. Government does not mean mind control in Latin.
Of course it does. Govern, it comes from the word govern, which means control, and mente, which means mind. So the word government in all literality means mind control.
Okay, I can't refute it, so I'll
stick
with
that.
Okay, so
we'll just say okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just important that all of your listeners, you know, question everything that's being said.
Big,
you know,
Brother
movies,
is watching.
The newspapers, et cetera, et cetera. And I just wanted to throw that out there and bring it up.
Wait a minute. Here.
Wait, now you're driving Peter crazy.
I'm trying to see if I can Latin mind control. All I get is stuff about Latin America. Llaves de mi corazón. What is it? The key to my heart.
The heart, yeah.
The key to my heart.
That's Spanish.
Yeah. Oh, it's a Stephen Marley album.
Ah.
Yeah. I'll look into this further. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like
appreciate
to know that
it.
Too.
All right. Latin. Any Latin teachers out there or Latin speakers? But does government, is the root of the word government mind control? Here's Joe in Morris, Michigan. Hey, Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, just calling you guys. I kept talking to you a couple weeks ago. I made a comment about some of the fuel prices and things and about, you know, blockading cities like New York and stuff like that.
Sure. How about Detroit?
Well, you got to pick big ones that would really make a difference where all the politicians are at. But I'll tell you what, I talked to a lot of these guys out here on the road, and, you know, it's about a 35-70 deal.
Yeah.
A lot of them just ain't got the guts to do it. That's quite depressing.
You mean they're working on commission?
Well,
they got to keep
way,
making money.
Shut down these cities so we get these fuel prices down, gas prices.
Sure.
You
sure.
know, it's ridiculous. And another thing, comment on these veterans, I feel for you guys, and I got two fingers up for Bush and all of his people for not helping them when they come home hurt.
Yeah, and there's lots of them, and we're going to be paying for these people for 50 years. Probably.
And you mean two fingers on different hands.
Yeah, there you go.
Not the peace sign.
I know. When I was thinking, peace sign, what is he talking about? Okay, I'm with you now.
It's the two middle ones.
Yeah, we got you.
All right, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks,
at 313-298-WRIF. Pardon me. Barack Obama on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine with this, and, you know, looks like almost a religious painting. You know, that's funny. Nobody,
it really does, doesn't it?
Yeah. They've endorsed, Rolling Stone has endorsed him, Barack Obama, A New Hope. He's brought up a lot of stuff, but unless people really push him, it's going to be, you know, a change, but not a great change. And we need a great, great change. You know, nobody's talked, you know, we've only got about 10 minutes left, and don't bother with this. No one has talked about the Kwame Kilpatrick situation in Detroit. I'm not trying to solicit calls on this because...
Well, it's funny you say that, Peter, because at dinner earlier, someone asked me, you know, what are you going to talk about tonight on the show? And, of course, I had a couple little things I threw out, and then they said, what about Kwame? And I said, you know, frankly, we have opened it up on this show. People are sick of it.
Well,
but there is, tomorrow there's something coming down. Right?
What's there is. I think at 11 o'clock, the prosecutor of Wayne County is going to announce what, if any, charges are going to be leveled against Kwame Kilpatrick and his ex-aide. I think there's going to be some charges. I mean, it is so clear of a violation of perjury that if Kim Worthy, the prosecutor, doesn't come up with some charges, she's going to look like part of the rot.
Yeah, she's under a little bit of pressure.
Yeah, well, good.
Yeah, good. I
she
agree.
Should be.
I agree.
She should be. And I think that I think there's going to be an indictment, which hopefully, I mean, think about Elliot Spitzer. I mean, he just said, yeah, man, I really screwed up. I embarrassed everybody, and I'm out of here. And that's what Kwame Kilpatrick should do as well, obviously. Here's Chris in White Lake. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to throw out, about that Kwame thing.
Yeah, forget about Kwame.
Okay, well, anyways.
we agree. Everybody agrees about
Kwame. Sorry, this is my first time on the air.
Hey, okay, man, you're doing great.
Wait a minute, in or out?
What?
Kwame, in or out?
I think he needs to get out of there.
There you go.
All right. What about the environment, though? Because you're out there in a pretty nice area, White Lake.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're getting a lot of industrialization out here. We're getting Target, stuff like that. But I think that we should take a little bit of money out of the stuff that we're paying for oil and try and invest it in research to make solar-powered cars.
Oh, yeah,
well,
or the money from the war.
Yeah, well, the other thing to do is that you could have massive, and we say, wait a minute, don't we want decentralized? But decentralized large facilities that produce the electricity, both solar and wind power with wind fields, and people could have do the deal where, like in up in Alaska and all that, when you pull up to a store, you plug in your car to keep the oil pan warm. So, because you don't want your oil at 40 below zero. Well, you could have that. You could plug in, and instead of keeping your oil pan, well, there they would need two plugs. But down here, what we would do would be to recharge our cars while people are in shopping at Target, hopefully not in White Lake. All right, but that's a good idea. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate that.
And yeah, thanks for calling for the first time.
Yeah, sure. And it's not a new idea. Like I said, this was what Henry Ford and Thomas Edison had planned 100 years ago, 1908, that Henry Ford, who did so much innovation with the internal combustion engine, only didn't invent it or anything, but that he saw them as loud, polluting, dangerous, and what have you.
And look at us now.
Yeah, and he was down with the idea of electric cars, but it got sabotaged. Why can't I even remember the name of the book by Edwin Black? Oh, I will find that in a second. Okay, I'm just almost thought of it. Here's Pat in Milford. Matt, hi, it's Peter and Jolene.
It's Pat from Milford.
What did I say?
He said Pat, then he said Matt. We're good.
Oh, I got you. I got you. Good to hear it. Hey,
hi, Pat.
On that very point you had just now, I wouldn't plan on talking about this, but if the I checked into putting solar on my house, and Detroit Edison doesn't have a payback portion of it. There's no agreements. They're one of the few companies that don't have a payback on it. So if you put solar on your house, I don't believe you can feed it back and actually get credit for it into the system.
You mean if you actually produce a surplus?
Yeah, oftentimes you can sell it back.
Right. And I think one of the fastest ways to get out of this whole energy thing would be to allow people to do that, to offset at retail rates until the point that their bill equals zero, and then sell it to the power company at wholesale rates.
Sure.
Knock down. I mean, it just makes so much sense, but I don't believe the mechanism is there. I could be wrong on that, though.
Well, I don't know what. I mean, what we need is a massive infrastructure investment that would provide jobs, creating that, and then get us completely off of oil.
Bingo. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Which brings me to why I originally called. Two reasons I called. The first being the guy who talked about the $150 oil well that's capped in Alaska or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories like that, and a lot of what I do this like for investing. I look at a lot of this stuff, and then a lot of this is there's oil in the ground, but it isn't as cheap to pump out as it used to be. It doesn't squirt out anymore when you find a new well. You have to usually do a whole lot of remedial type stuff. And in Alaska, it's really hard because they're even doing wacky things like, you know, putting microwaves down there to thaw it out, to make it more viscous to pump out and everything like that. So there might be cases like that, but it might cost them $125 to get that barrel of oil.
Yeah, it's not like there will be blood, you know, where you have gushers in Texas. And
exactly,
stuff
exactly.
Like that.
So there might be some truth to it, but there might be some economic reasons. But the main reason I called is back to your original, early in your conversations today, you're talking about the economy, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree with you just a little bit about the market. Although maybe I'm agreeing with you in a different sense about the government.
But tell me quick, because we're almost completely out of time. Yeah.
One of the reasons we're in a problem right now is because the government has interfered, I believe, with the markets and the interest rates. And by the interference, I mean constantly bailing out predominantly companies, but usually under the guise of bailing out individuals, for making stupid mistakes, which foster stupider mistakes in the future, which foster more stupid mistakes.
Well, let me just say that in terms of these bailouts, yeah, the individual who made a bad decision on a mortgage, or the individual who is having problems with their business, either because they made a bad mistake or just the nature of the economy, they don't get bailed out. It's essentially the wealthy politicians bailing out their buddies. But the feeling is, I mean, the argument is that without that kind of government intervention, that things would get even worse. But there is a big debate there. If you go to nytimes.com, if you haven't already, you in Sunday's paper, you can see that how these different economic, the theorists say, yeah, you know, just let them crash. Of course, you know, let them crash. Too many of us are going to crash with it. All right, thank you very much. I'm sorry we couldn't talk more, but I got to end it. And, Don, my apologies for leaving you stranded. I was trying to get it completely, to get everybody on. Well, Jolene Jordan, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Peter. Thank
you. Al Slayer, thank you so much for doing the phones. And we're going to do an hour of interesting interviews, both of them actually about the economy and the impact on us and on our state. And then at 2 a.m., Al Slayer rocks you.
Rocking all the way to Drew and Mike.
We'll talk next week.
Listening, WRIF.com.
It's Rockin' Racing Day with a Riff.
Join 101 WRIF live on location Saturday, March 29th at New York, New York in Chesterfield
as we gear up for the Gainesco 8300 from Homestead, Miami
with free live performances from Tantric. Plus, that same night, Cinder Road.
With special guest Detroit's own Matt Austin.
It'll be one hell of a party as we get ready for WRIF's first race broadcast of 2008. Join us for the party Saturday, March 29th at New York, New York. Inside the Premier Entertainment Complex on 23 Mile, just 2 miles east of I-94 in Chesterfield. With your rockin' racing station.
101
WRIF.
The Riff.
Come with me because you're looking so fine that I really want to make you mine. I said you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. Hell, 4, 5, 6, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need money when you look like that, do you, honey? Said, are you gonna be my girl? Please tell my hand to come with me, because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. For five cents, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need money with a face like that, do ya? I said, are you gonna...
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thank you for joining me. I don't think it's news to anybody that we're in a bad economic dilemma. There's even talk of economic catastrophe. Usually when you hear about this, it's talking about the biggies, the Bear Stearns, how the Wall Street investors. Of course, we've read and heard a lot about the people that have lost their homes for foreclosure because of subprime loans. But this problem with credit, with debt, with a diminishing value of the dollar, with the high price of commodities, everything from what we buy at the pump to what we buy at the stores, is diminishing all of our wages, even if we're not in a particularly precarious position. Joining me, or I should say welcoming back to the Peter Werby Show, is Tamara Drought, and she is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at Demos. Demos is a nonpartisan public policy research and advocacy organization that does issues of economic justice and opportunity. Now, Tamara Drought oversees Demos' research, policy, and advocacy work on issues related to economic security and mobility. You may remember in 2006 we interviewed her about her just published book then, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. Now, she has written the foreword to a brand new book. It's called Up to Our Eyeballs, and the subtitle is How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt. Jose Garcia, James Lardner, and Cindy Zeldin are the authors of that. Joining me from the Demos office in New York City, Tamara Drought. Welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
Now, as I said, suddenly we don't have to start shaking everybody by the lapels and saying, hey, there's an economic problem. Everybody is beginning to realize that this is number one issue on the news. When you began, and when the people that are the co-authors, and to which you wrote the foreword of Up to Our Eyeballs, there wasn't as great a realization of how deep the problem was there?
Well, you know, not among mainstream economists, and certainly not among the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, but there was a real feeling among people who were living their lives in debt and struggling to keep up with the rising cost of filling up the tank in the car and heating their homes. But there was less acknowledgement among sort of elite opinion makers, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Chair of the Federal Reserve, who, you know, really kept saying everything's going to be fine, and if we have a problem, it's really going to be limited. Meanwhile, you know, all of the friends in the line of work I do were, you know, trying to send up a red flag saying this is not a sustainable system and a whole lot of people are going to be hurt when this bubble bursts and these home mortgages reset. People are going to lose their homes. And indeed, for the first time, I really hate that I was right about this because it's disastrous.
Well, sure. You know what struck me? Back in 1999, I was advised by someone who will go unnamed that I should put all of the stocks in my 401k into tech stocks because I would make a fortune. And I said to this guy, who was a millionaire investor, I said, they're not making any profit. This is all a house of cards. He said, no. So I didn't move anything. And this time as well, it seemed pretty obvious to, if you will, the common people, because there is getting to be that divide between the elites and us commoners, that we know a lot more than the guys that are running things.
It sure does seem that way. And, you know, people have been telling the folks who do run things that this isn't working. Meanwhile, you have, you know, when you look at just what's happening to the rise in foreclosures and the meltdown in the subprime mortgage market, you know, by and large, these were folks that were sold a bill of goods and were often desperate to believe that they were getting a decent mortgage and would be able to make their mortgage payments. You know, this is particularly true in cases like Ohio and Detroit, where people have suffered serious unemployment. And, you know, what happened in these neighborhoods, and this has been documented fairly well, is mortgage brokers basically swarmed into these neighborhoods, knocked on people's doors who were in a desperate place and needed some reason to be helpful, and told them, you know, don't worry, we can refinance your mortgage, we're going to lower your mortgage payment, and by the time these mortgages do reset and you have a higher payment, you'll be able to refinance no problem. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people traded in their good, solid, standard 30-year fixed mortgages for these exploding adjustable-rate mortgages and are going to pay the steepest price, and that is they're going to lose their home.
Well, Tamara, as odd as it may seem, there are still some neoconservatives left who put the blame on the individual lender. Now, the subtitle of Up to Our Eyeballs is How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt. And we've heard a lot how, and I think you said, use the phrase, sold potential lenders a bill of goods. But they still say, listen, this is capitalism, caveat emptor, buyer beware, that the responsibility in their world worldview lies with the person who did not investigate enough as to what they were getting. That probably that if they had, they would say, wait a minute, I'm not getting a good deal at all. In fact, this is going to screw me later on. So it's the victim game that these people really are responsible for their own choices.
That's right. And you know what's wrong with that argument is the fact that we want it both ways. The people that say this argument want it both ways. They want to hold up our financial system as the best in the world because of its transparency and its accountability and its sophistication. And then on the other hand, they want the average person to be able to make unbiased, informed decisions. But the system is so rigged against the individual consumer where you have – and so we're told the banking system is the soundest in the world, it's accountable, it's honest, it's open. So when a mortgage broker knocks on somebody's door and says, I represent a bank, I can get you a loan, and somebody says, you know, I'm worried I'm not going to be able to afford this, oh, no, the bank wouldn't give you the loan if you couldn't afford it. And people believe that. They believe that if the bank is willing to give them this money, they must be able to afford it. And so for all the people that keep saying, well, you know, they should have checked the fine print, they should have known better, they should have thought that maybe they wouldn't be able to refinance, you can't have it both ways. You can't hold up sort of our system and say it's the most reliable, honest, transparent, sophisticated, and at the same time, blame individuals when something goes wrong.
Has something changed? Because years ago, when my wife and I bought our home, I didn't read any of that. It was pages and pages of stuff. And she said, well, do you think we should take this to a lawyer? I said, it's our bank. You know, let's sign it. You know, the rate is good. And as it turned out, it was perfectly okay. But that was quite a number of years ago. Did something change? Was there like a watershed event or something that allowed, did it make that you had to read the fine print or you took a real risk?
Well, a lot has changed, and I think a lot of it goes back to some policy changes, but also to technology. Because people now, there's more underwriting through credit scoring. There's mortgage brokers, which by and large didn't really exist up until maybe a decade or so ago. And one thing that now people that's starting to come out is that the mortgage broker doesn't work for the borrower.
Mm-hmm.
They work for themselves. And they have a vested interest in getting the homeowner to take out the largest mortgage possible at the highest possible interest rate. Because the higher the interest rate and the larger the mortgage, the higher their commission. The other thing that has changed is that we now have a whole market based on securities, So a bank gives the homeowner a mortgage, and then they bundle up all these mortgages, slice and dice them into different bundles based on whether they're a bunch of subprime mortgages or prime mortgages, and then they sell it. So it's sort of off their sheets and out of their hands, but it's already well off the mortgage broker's plate. So what happened is there's no accountability because the buck keeps getting passed. And at the end of the day, it was investors holding these pools of mortgages that were in default. And the problem, there's sort of conflicts of interest up and down sort of the whole lending pipeline, but it starts with the mortgage broker who only has their personal self-interest at stake in making the mortgage to the potential homeowner.
Well, it seems that the financial center of the United States should really be in Las Vegas instead of on Wall Street in New York, where you're talking to us from, because it so much of it is just turned into these odd speculative financial interests, rather than, you know, stock being sold in order to finance the operation of a building, or of a business, rather,
right.
or of a home, getting a home loan, and then
right.
The single lender that lent it to you getting interest on that loan. Now, I read Paul Krugman in the you're in New York. Is it Krugman or Krugman?
Krugman. That's how I know it, but
okay.
Who knows?
Paul Krugman in the New York Times. He'll mention certain financial instruments that are key to the operation of our economic and financial system, and he'll say, don't ask. In other words, they are so
right.
arcane, so bizarre, so complex, so labyrinthine, that it is way beyond any of us. And it may be beyond even the people that have set them in motion.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is these are highly complex instruments, and please don't ask me to explain them because I can't explain them either. That really nobody understands, except there's among sort of your consumer advocates, there was a long acknowledgement that, there was something wrong with this system, and that at the end of the day, sure, Wall Street might make a ton of money, but that it was built on a house of cards, and that unfortunately the houses that it was built on were where your ordinary people, you know, hung their hat at the end of the day. And that to me is what the tragedy of all of this is that so many people made billions of dollars on this very risky game of selling adjustable rate mortgages. They've already made their money, they're happy, and now the homeowners are paying the price, the ultimate price here. And at the same time, the government is now bailing out, you know, to the tune of $30 billion, the institutions that really propagated this entire mess and kept it going for a long time.
Sure. Tamara Drought is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. She's the Director of Economic Opportunity Program for Demos. You can go to Demos, DEMOS.org, for lots more information. And she has written the foreword to the book, Up to Our Eyeballs, How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt. And it's published by the New Press. And I'll have a link to it on my website as well. Jose Garcia, James Lardner, and Cindy Zeldin wrote the essays in here. What do they tell us in Up to Our Eyeballs?
Well, you know, it's a great book. I'm biased, but you know what it does. The book looks at all different types of lending, so it covers everything from the proliferation of these payday loan storefronts to credit card lending to the student loan market to the mortgage market, and it looks at two things. It looks at how public policy and sort of the economic world has changed and has left your ordinary average American a lot more vulnerable. So more people living paycheck to paycheck. If somebody loses a job, our safety net is not nearly as strong as it used to be. So things like credit cards and payday loans are the way that many households are keeping food in the fridge and the lights on when somebody loses a job or when they're hit with an extreme medical situation.
Well, the argument without compassion, again, from conservatives that you hear, these people are overspending their budget. They've been watching too much television and buy, and think they can get it all for free pretty much by putting it on their credit card. And, it's coming, as all bad debt does, comes back to haunt them. So, but they're responsible, not the system, not the industry.
Right.
Yeah. What do you say to that, or what do they say?
I think the one point that I agree with is that, yes, they are spending too much money, and they're spending too much money on things like health care, the cost of a college education, child care, and filling up the gas tank, and more for things like housing. So absolutely, but it's not the extras that are really hurting people and putting them over the edge. It's the sort of core of their living expenses that have just risen and risen and risen, while their incomes have either declined or been pretty much flat over the last 8 years.
Now, is this sort of observational, or is this available in statistics? I mean,
it's available in statistics. Absolutely. If you look at the cost of things like healthcare. Double-digit increase. It's increased about 70% since the beginning of 2000. Housing has shot way up. Child care. The cost of a college education is up 40% since 2000. So, and then if you look at the typical incomes of working households, they've been relatively flat for the last 6-7 years.
Yeah, and I was thinking that the cost of food last year went up 5%. You say, 5%, that's not very much. But if you're making $20,000 a year, what is that, $1,000? Yeah, it's an increase of $1,000 more. And if you're making $20,000, pardon me, and the government says a family of four can live on $20,000 a year and not be counted among the poor.
Right.
I think when we talked last time about your book Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30 somethings Can't Get Ahead, I think we talked that if there was a realistic statistic, I think the number of people living in poverty in this country could come close to doubling, up around 60, 70 million.
And indeed, that's about what, when people are asked in surveys what they really think it takes for a family of four to get by in the United States today, pretty much anywhere in the country, the minimum is close to about double the poverty line. Most people think it takes a family of four about $40,000 to get by anywhere in the nation. And the reality is they're right. And while a household of 20,000 making $20,000 a year wouldn't fall in the official poverty statistics, they certainly get counted as sort of a great profit center for a lot of these lenders, particularly the payday lending industry, the credit card industry, the student loan industry, and the subprime mortgage industry.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, up to our eyeballs has the first three words in the subtitle is how shady lenders. Now, do you include, like, for instance, all these paycheck, you had the phrase for it, paycheck loan places?
Payday lenders.
Describe that. You know, it occurred to me, I thought I knew what that was, but I'm not 100% sure. Describe the process. And are they all shady by definition, or do they, to some extent, provide a service?
Well, that's a good question. They certainly provide a service because there are definitely times when people face pretty serious shortages in cash. The car breaks down. They go to the doctor, they go to the dentist, and they need to come up with a couple $100 that they don't have in their savings account, which most lower income, moderate income households don't have that much in their savings. So they do provide a service. But that service is provided in exchange for pretty much anywhere from 300% annual percentage rate to 500, 600% annual percentage rate.
Well, I don't mean to sound naive, but aren't there usury laws that you cannot have extraordinary interest on? I mean, you should go to the local mafia. I think you'd get a better rate.
Right. Well, there used to be usury laws. And what has happened, and that's one of the key sort of through lines in the book that we talk about, is the steady deregulation of the lending industry. And it used to be that most states had caps on small loans in terms of what you could charge in interest. Many, many states have relaxed those or let them go altogether. In New York State, we still have a good usury limit for small loans, so we don't have payday lenders. But if you go to a state like Mississippi, Ohio,
Michigan.
Illinois, you'll see them all over the place.
Well, let's go back to this just for a second. So they're not in New York City or New York State because because they cannot make these extraordinary rates of interest on. They're not satisfied with making a decent amount.
Right. You know, they could charge 15%, 20%. You know, you asked me to explain how they work. Basically, you go in, you give them a check, a post-dated check, that they are going to cash on your payday. And in that check, if you want, let's say, if you need $200, you make the check out for $250.
Okay.
To cover their fee. Now, what happens to most people is 2 weeks later or a week later when payday comes due, many people don't have that in their account, so they roll it over. And so then that's another fee on top of that. And what originally turned out to be a $200 loan quickly turns into a $600 loan. And on it goes. In fact, I think there's been some studies, the typical payday loan customer rolls over their loans five or six times before they're able to pay it off. So, you know, one of the things we talk about in the book is the need for alternatives. Credit unions are now coming up with alternatives to payday lenders. Many credit unions are helping their members pay off a payday loan and put that money in a savings account instead. The head of the FDIC, Sheila Baird, has said, you know, we need banks to provide low-cost personal loans for people facing emergencies so that they have somewhere else to go other than a payday lender or a pawn shop or a credit card.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of our talk, Tamara Drought, that that the people around you and the foreseeing non-elite economists knew that this was the policies we had in place were unrealizable, I'm wondering what the average person, how they now face a pretty frightening economic future. And one of the things I was thinking about during a bull market, when the market is expanding, people, they write books like they did during the 90s, Dow 40,000, that would go up like that. And now when we're in a bear market, when things are contracting, that people, I've read things, you probably have as well, is that the currency is going to be devalued by 90%. We're going to lead a world a depression like we've never seen before, or even wind up like Japan. Well, this would be less. Wind up like Japan in a 10-year recession. What do these same people have a feeling about where we're heading now?
Well, you know, I think they think we're headed into trouble. One, that we are most definitely in the midst of a recession. It's a recession that probably could, unfortunately, be pretty prolonged and deep. You know, there's a lot of things working against your average household right now, the weakening of the dollar, the fallout in the credit markets, which is now sort of having all sorts of ripple effects through the economy in a way that that I think even those who were sounding the alarm are a little surprised at how much this is affecting all different sectors of the economy. So I think we're in trouble, and I think if you look at what voters are caring about, the economy has pretty much become the number one issue on people's minds, more so than the war at this point. And people are looking for somebody to offer them a better way of managing our economy than we've had for the last almost decade.
Now, one thing we should think about, and none of the political candidates talk about this, is when everything is tallied, we're spending $1 trillion a year on a war budget, which
right.
everything concerned. And that's like the 800-pound gorilla in the room that
right.
nobody even mentioned. I shouldn't say that. I'm not even sure that most people are aware that there's this enormous amount of taxpayer dollars that are going out the window to with a pretty low return on what pump priming is supposed to do. But I don't think anybody is going to, and certainly not the Republican, and I don't think either the Democratic Party candidates either either will raise that, which could be the key to it all. I mean, suddenly that would free up quite a bit of money.
Well, I you know, and when I've watched sort of some of the debates, I feel like the candidates, at least the Democratic candidates, are saying, you know, we're spending billions and billions of dollars each month on this war, and that's money that's being diverted from shoring up our own public infrastructure, from strengthening our public schools, from having universal health care, things that we need to and should have done years ago, but that we need to really dedicate ourselves to doing at this point.
60 seconds left. I'm sorry to interrupt. It occurred to me that, and I think this will probably be a short answer, people write me all the time, what should I do? Where are the resources? What can I do as an individual? And I write back, I say, I don't know. And I suspect that you're not a financial advisor, Tamara Drought, but any general pieces of advice to people listening?
Well, one, think about this problem not only in terms of your personal situation, but realize that it is a political problem, and that we need leaders to stand up for the ordinary interests of individuals rather than for the banks and hedge funds that really led us down this really disastrous path. If you need help, I recommend go to the website Americans for Fairness and Lending. You can find a credit counselor in your area there. You can get hooked up with legal help if you need it. And their website is AFFIL.org.
Well, thank you so much, Tamara Drought. She's written the foreword to a must-read book, Up to Our Eyeballs, How Shady Lenders and Failed Economic Policies Are Drowning Americans in Debt. Jose Garcia, James Lardner, and Cindy Zeldin cooperated on the contents. You can go to Demos, DEMOS.org, for more information on Tamara Drought's organization. And also there'll be a link to all of this on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Thanks for joining me on the show.
My pleasure. Take care.
This is WRIM.com.
As you and your family enjoy a peaceful and joyous Easter weekend, leave it to your friends at the Rift to drop an irreverent and totally uncalled for joke. What has nine arms and rocks? Yeah, I think you know the answer.
All right, listen up!
Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all weekend long for your chance to score free tickets for the return of Def Leppard, April 19th at Children's Arena. One lucky Rift winner will score an awesome grand prize package, including dinner before the show, limousine transportation to and from the concert, and once you get there, you'll be checking out Def Leppard up close and personal from the front row. Listen and win from your concert station, 101 WRIF.
Well, it filters through.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. This is Peter Werby. Those of you who have listened to this broadcast over a number of years may remember very much so that on any number of occasions, maybe as many as three before, I've interviewed Ishmael Ahmed. He was the co-founder and a longtime director of Access. Access is the largest Arab American human service organization in the United States, and they have like 90 different programs. It's still going on strong. It services more than 900,000 clients annually, and Access stands for Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. Also, we talked with Ishmael Ahmed about the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. That is such a community treasure, and he had so much to do with setting up and making sure that it operated at such a high quality. Also, the Concert of Colors, and that's Detroit's premier free event of world music from everywhere, from the United States to Africa, Asia, Latin America, and back. And I was surprised, and he is in the studio with us, and he'll have to tell us, that he was appointed by Governor Jennifer M. Granholm as director of the Michigan Department of Human Services last September. This is an enormous department, has 10,000 employees, administers a $4 billion-plus annual budget. It serves 1.5 million medical assistance cases and 1.2 million cash and food assistance cases. So it's a pleasure, as always, to welcome back also a personal friend, Ishmael Ahmed, to the Peter Werby Show. Thanks for coming back. And thanks for coming in. I know you have an extraordinarily busy schedule.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Were you surprised? I mean, I said, Ishmael Ahmed is now going to be the head of this enormous Department of Human Services?
Well, I was surprised, you know, to get the phone call, to be honest, and not sure whether it was something I wanted to do at first. But the more I thought about it, we were helping out thousands of people every year at Access. Here was a chance to help out millions of people, and so I agreed to do it in September.
Well, you sort of answered my question, because I was going to say the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, Access, helped so many people, and you had such a hands-on and direct connection with it all. I was fearful that suddenly you'd be enmeshed in this enormous bureaucracy where you wouldn't be able to carry out the kind of social conscience and desire for social and economic justice that you've always brought to our community. But I guess that you took it means that you feel satisfied you can make a difference.
Well, I think I can, you know, running a gigantic department like this versus a community agency where there are hundreds of people working and another one where there are tens of thousands of people working, you know, and the problems are so difficult and the finances are so challenging that you can't change everything. You can try to do the best you can, and that's what I'm trying to do. But I think that there are some things that we can do that can make a tremendous difference. I believe, for instance, we can reform the child welfare system. You know, that's the system that the DHS runs that includes adoptions and, you know, foster care and daycare licensing and, you know, juvenile justice and hundreds of programs that deal with vulnerable children. I believe that that system is due for reform. And it's something that's accomplishable. So we'll be doing that. We'll be trying to improve the number of people who are receiving food stamps. We think that there are hundreds of thousands of people more who should have a right to those that have low incomes and need that support in their lives. Also, we'll be concentrating on our energy on assuring that programs that we run that are job-oriented provide the supports that people need and the education that people need, and not just that we demand that they work or we cut them off.
I have to say, in doing the kind of phone-in talk shows that I've done over the years, the number of people who, working people that pay taxes and that carry out the resentment in their lives towards poor people through complaining about people on welfare has diminished considerably because there's considerably less people on what we used to call welfare. Yet I just received an email the other day. You know, I work. Why do I have to support people on welfare? Maybe, Ishmael Ahmed, would you just tell us what constitutes so-called welfare today and who the people are on it? I mean, still there's this idea that there's these able-bodied men that are going out and buying Mad Dog 2020 with the check that you and I pay for.
Well, first of all, there are about 80,000 people who are on cash assistance. That's what's normally looked at as welfare, and that number is the highest it's ever been. It's been fairly steady for the last couple years, but the reason that people should be supportive is it could be you. I'll be talking about this a little later in the discussion. A huge number of people who used to work, who have a very strong work ethic, no longer are able to work and need support until they're able to find work. The second reason is that the majority of people who are on cash assistance aren't able to work. They physically are not able to work. They have a whole plethora of problems in their lives that they have to get past. And now it's also a limited program. You can be on it 5, maybe 7 years, and then you no longer are eligible for the rest of your life. So it's an important program, but the majority of people actually who the department works with are vulnerable children in the child welfare system, tens of thousands of them. They are people who have food stamp supplements. They may work but don't make enough to live, and so we supplement them so they can live. Or they may be seniors who didn't have enough when they retired, or the company they had went bust and left them with nothing, and so they live on a $1 a meal per day. That's what food stamps provides. Sure. Try living on that. You couldn't buy a Starbucks coffee. That would be your day's supplement from food stamps. So these are very, very meager amounts of money to help people who really do need it. The stories about the, in quotes, food stamp cheats, and there are probably some, and there always probably will be some on any kind of program, whether it's, what's commonly called welfare, cash assistance, or anything else will exist, but they exist in very, very small numbers. When you apply for cash assistance, you're sent right to an employment office and expected to find work immediately. You join a work program. These are not the old days, and in some ways, maybe we've gone too far. Many people are being forced off the rolls, frankly, who really do have legitimate reason to be supported. But the important argument I'd make is tens of thousands of people who never thought that they would ever have to rely on government today are now being pushed into unemployment and need support.
He was just joining us. My guest is Ishmael Ahmed. He is the director of the Department of Human Services for the state of Michigan. Maybe, and this is my fault, we're backing into this where we should really put this within the context of poverty in Michigan. We always say euphemistically on the media that our economy is challenging. We don't want to poor mouth the city or the city or the state, and we don't want to create the context where we think, wow, we're in this poverty ridden state, but in many ways we are. We're pretty low on the national totem pole, aren't we?
We are, but increasingly we're the vanguard of the nation on this, and I'm sorry to say that, but look around you. Unemployment is up in every single state. We are courting economic disaster in so many ways. We can't afford not to have a safety net for people and a way forward, an approach that provides education and jobs for people. And so we've got to work systematically to do that. In Michigan today, the department alone serves almost 2 million people who need that safety net. There are only 10 million people in the state, so 1 out of 5 people are served directly by the department. But that really doesn't tell the story. You know, to me, the dividing line is, can you live on the amount of income you have, whether you work or don't work? And one out of three people in this state do not make enough to live. That's the term that's been called low income.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it means you don't make enough to live. And so in some way, we need to provide a way forward for them, a safety net, but more important, jobs and education and the ability for people to live.
When your department publishes figures, it says the Michigan median income is $46,000 annually. That doesn't sound so bad in many ways.
Yeah, but it's a challenge even on $46,000.
And half make less.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Even on $46,000 to raise a family in the society now. You're talking about maybe a family of four or five children. That just puts you up above the difficult things that you have to go through to live. And more than half of the people do not make that much money. And so we really are challenged both as a state and a country. And, you know, we should call it what it is. We're in a recession. And that recession is playing hell with people's lives, real people, real lives, and real pain. And for us not to have the political will to take that on is a real mistake.
Well, there is certainly the political will, but it seems in many ways at the basis of all that, and I know you agree with this, that there has to be the ethical understanding that it's a necessity, that these are fellow human beings, members of our community. And yet I come up so many times, and maybe it's just the squeaky wheels. Maybe I think because when you see the statistics for polls, people say, yes, we have to help the vulnerable. But you always get a lot of very angry people that say, I work, I have two jobs, why should any of my money go to support others? And you said earlier that, hey, it could be you. Yeah, it could. Most people don't anticipate that, but it's almost like there's a compassion deficit here as well.
Well, I think somebody long ago sold us the idea that we could have, you know, everything we want without paying for it, without, you know, making sure that it happens. And so when I talk about political will here, I'm talking about what priority are we giving to this? You know, we got X billion dollars in the state. It's not enough to do everything. What priority does making sure kids, you know, can live, that families do not starve? You know, whether you're religious or not religious, most of us believe that it's the right thing to do, you know, to help our neighbors and our friends get through. But somehow that does not come through in our budget priorities. It doesn't come through in the activism of people working to make that happen. You know, twice I know of in our history, the fight against poverty became a national issue, once in the 1930s and again in the 1960s. The war on poverty was lost. You know, that doesn't mean that it's not worth fighting for. I think it's really, really important that we get out there and point out that poverty is not a word. You know, it is a reality for people. That means that you may not have the health care you need, or you may not have the mental health care that you need, or you may not have enough to eat, or you may not have a home, or you may have to live in the underground economy, as they call it, you know, in order to survive. You know, why is it that we have more people in prison and we spend more on prisons than we do for that kind of support for our own families?
And the prison population, of course, is directly connected to poverty. I mean, they have all these studies why people and spend millions of dollars trying to figure out why people become criminals. And no one's asked me, or probably you, because obviously within poverty context, there's a desperation or maybe even a meanness that comes from the deprivation that impels people to commit crimes. I mean, you don't see a lot of criminals coming out of West Bloomfield or Grosse Pointe, at least, you know, what, Woody Guthrie's song, Pretty Boy Floyd, he said, some men will rob you with a six gun, others with a fountain pen. So those guys are the fountain pen guys. But the crime we're concerned about emanates directly from poverty. I think you'd agree with
that. Well, I think poverty generates crime and so many other things. But I think there's another part of the equation that people don't pay attention to. You know, we talk about having a workforce in this state or people being educated so that they can get the kind of jobs that they need. We're leaving a whole third of our population behind. This state cannot be successful. Our hopes for the future cannot be successful by leaving a third of our people behind, you know, so that they cannot participate in the improvement of life for this state. And so, you know, it's not just that we need to provide a safety net, but we need to help people move on with their lives. If they need to re-skill or retool themselves, if they need to educate themselves for those jobs that are out there and they want to work, we need to make that possible. You know, if they're young or old and want to re-educate themselves, go back to school, we need to make that possible. We cannot survive, you know, as a community and as a state without doing that.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Ishmael Ahmed, the director of the Department of Human Services of the state of Michigan. You can go to mi.gov/DHS for information on all the programs. But let's go through some of these, what the Department of Human Services is providing for citizens. Is it all there? Is it a matter of your department not having, not being able to serve everybody that needs serving, or not enough people applying, or both?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, there are programs that people are eligible for, food stamps in particular, that they are not making use of. We'd encourage people to do that. That's all federal money, you know, and we might as well spend some of it on our folks here in Michigan instead of watching it go all over the place. I don't want to be insulary, but I think that, you know, that's a good use of that money, feeding people. But also over the years, you've seen these programs reduced and reduced and reduced, with the exception of a very small incremental addition this year, I think, to the clothing allowance and general assistance. I think we went from $45 to $75 to clothe a child for the entire year.
Whoa.
There has been no change in the amount of money people receive for maybe 15 years. And so the dollars that we're able to put in people's hands to survive is not keeping pace. I talked to you about food stamps, which provides $1 per meal. Nobody can live on that. And so, and the eligibility and the length of time you can be on is being constantly reduced. If you're disabled, and we run the disability program for Social Security, which has hundreds of thousands of people in it, you know, it's harder and harder to get into that program. The barriers grow every year. A lot of those are federal decisions. And so, yes, there are programs for people. We want to encourage you to make use of them, you know, if you're eligible for them. But is it enough, especially on the jobs and education side of this? The answer is absolutely not.
Is this a result of political mean-spiritedness that comes across this country every so often with no real compassion for the poor or the needy? Or is it the fact that there just isn't any money?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think in Michigan in particular, there really is not a whole lot of money slushing around out there. And so certainly in terms of priorities, the regular folks have not made it clear that they want a safety net to be part of that priority in the way they need to, or the protection of children in the child welfare system, you know, to be done. So you have things like, if you go to a general assistance office or what we commonly call a welfare office, a human services office, you will find a caseworker who has what's acceptable is about 200 cases. They have 600 to 800 cases. Some people have 1,000 cases. How do you do a good job for people with those kind of numbers? And it's the same thing in the child welfare system. It's supposed to be foster care, 12 to 1. It's actually 35 to 1.
That's amazing. I was way back in the day, I was a welfare, what they called a public welfare worker, I think, or something for the old City of Detroit program, and I had 75 cases, and I thought I was overwhelmed. I should say, by the way, you were talking about this, you know, the phenomena, the mostly mythological phenomena of the welfare cheat. In the 2 or 3 years I did that, I never, and I was an investigator. I was supposed to investigate people's eligibility, and I never found one person. I'm sure people do, but I don't think our money is being ill-spent on welfare. It's being ill-spent elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree with you, and the department does have a pretty crack unit that tracks down fraud, and so there are a huge number of prosecutions. I think it's not wrong to do that. I think that people who misuse the system should be called on it. That is not the rule by any stretch of the imagination. This is an infinitesimal number of people. But for me, the big thing I really want to do is begin to raise the question of poverty in our state and in our society in a way that gets heard. And you can't do that by yourself. You know, people like you inviting me on to talk about it is great. We're going to be doing a statewide summit on poverty in November, where we expect something in the range of 3,000 to 5,000 people from across the state to come. And it won't just be experts. It'll be people who, you know, suffer from poverty, who can tell their story. It'll be students, and it'll be workers, and it'll be moms and pops and legislators, because we want them to hear. And, you know, the governor will be there. In fact, I'll tell you a little secret. I think a bunch of us are going to try to live on food stamps for a week or two ahead of time to kind of dramatize what a lot of people in Michigan go through.
You know, I was so heartened, and I am so heartened by everything you've been saying. And then all of a sudden, I just, in the back of my mind, I thought, how shameful this is that in the so-called richest country in the world, we're having a conference about poverty, of which, and this is a necessity that this happened, and I certainly will do everything I can to help publicize it. But it's shameful that we are at this point in our nation's history.
Well, I think it's shameful because it was not that long ago that on a national scale, we didn't have a deficit, and we were looking to, can we save Social Security? You know, what should we be doing for the poor? And at least that discussion was taking place. Now we're at war in two different places, and possibly more to come. We're over $1 trillion in debt, and we're being told that there isn't enough for common Americans who run into trouble. Something's wrong with that.
Sure. Well, we're almost at the end of our discussion. You know, one thing that really impressed me, I was all of this was our meeting here today was all set up by your assistant, Laura Linebaugh, and I called your office. I had something to tell her, and whoever answered said, oh, she's out delivering Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wait a minute. Here is somebody who's an assistant to the director of the Michigan Department of Human Services, and yet she herself is out delivering meals.
I think a lot of the people who work for the department have got a bad rap. I told you that how much of a load they carry. Many of them work late nights and on their lunch hours. You know, they give of their, you know, time and energy after work and things that they believe in. A lot of them work to help children out and do Meals on Wheels and so forth. You know, nobody's perfect. Out of 10,000 people, there's some bad apples. But I really believe that the 10,000 people that work for us are heroes. You know, they do much more than anyone can expect. Unfortunately, part of the mean-spiritedness out there is to blame the workers that do this work for, you know, the lack of money and the time that it takes that we've built into the system by underfunding it.
Well, we're out of time. Is the best place to investigate the services of the Department of Human Services the website I gave before, mi.gov/DHS?
Sure. And not only that, but you can actually email us there and tell us what you think or what you need or if you have questions, ask as well. Again, let me give a plug one more time for November 13th. The State Conference on Poverty that will be taking place at Cobo Hall, and all you out there are invited.
And you're invited back to tell us more about it when we get closer to it.
Sure.
Ismail Ahmed, thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
The Rick satisfies your need for speed with racing action that rocks. 101 WRIF and Firestone present exclusive IMS Radio Network coverage of the Gainesco Indy 300 from Homestead, Miami. Saturday, March 29th, starting at 7:30 in 2008. 101 WRIF is your home for Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network race coverage. From the green all the way to that checkered flag. The Gainesco Indy 300, live from Homestead, Miami. Presented by Firestone. Firestone, presenting sponsor of the Detroit Indy Grand Prix on 101 WRIF. The Riff.
Friday's when you left me, so I drink myself to sleep. And Sunday is when I wake up, not to remember a thing. I don't know my new girl too well. That all this lying gets to me. And no one seems to care with the way she talks to every guy in the bar. You should have raised some kind of alarm. Who would ever think I'd go and end up like all the other guys that you got in for?
Somewhere inside the Nubian mansion.
Oh, man, what a mess. Hey, somebody pull the navigator up to the back door, please.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, right, whatever.
This is 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Riff.